Okay, I'm going to start. We have a lot to cover in the next two sessions. So what we're going to cover, I've mentioned this in previous lectures, we're going to cover the B101, which is one of the American Institute of Architects form documents. It has a brief history, and we'll go over in another lecture in the second half of the semester kind of all the different form documents they use, the AA has created. But this form for an owner-architect or something very similar, you're going to see documents that don't say AIA on it, it's not going to have the logo and everything else, will be probably, you'll see the provisions in this form at the very least, and I would say roughly 75 to 80% of every owner-architect contract you'll ever see. These forms were created back at the turn of the century, not this century, but last century. And it was the American Institute of Architects who said, you know, we got to come together, let's create something for our people to protect the architects and put together a series of form agreements. Over the years, and it wasn't just owner-architect, they created an owner-contractor agreement, they created all subcontractor and various other types of agreements. And over the years, these became basically the adopted norm. So you'll see, as I said, you may not see an AIA actual form, and the one I sent you, you guys may have seen if you printed out or looked at it, there's a watermark on it. And in the last 20 years, they've made it very hard to get that. You have to have proprietary software to use it, because when you print it out, if it's not final, it'll say draft. If you just try to print like what you print I sent yesterday, if you go through the AIA software, which we have a license for, and then it has these redaction sheets and all these other things, because it's their work product, so they want to make sure that it's kept in its format. It also helps the way the software is written. It helps track what the exact changes are. So when you sign the contract, it'll be clean. The front end will be clean, but then there's an exhibit, an addenda, that says these are the revisions. It's called the additions and deletions report. So if there's ever any confusion or question later down the line where a lawyer comes in and says, well, why was this changed? You can see what the edits were that happened during the course of the negotiations. In any event, what happens with the AIA documents is every 10 years they're updated. So going back, in that 10-year cycle, I want to say started in the 60s. I'm not exactly sure, but I know that there's a 77, an 87, a 97, a 2007. We're working off the 2017s, and what will happen is in 2027, they're actually in the process of drafting the 2027s right now. The 2027 hits, they'll release them, and it's normally in the fall of that year. It takes about a year to burn in, so when you have, if you're working on contracts or documents and if you still want to use a 2017, the AIA software will allow you to use that 2017 until the fall of 2028 because they've released the 2027, and then they cut off all access to it. The purpose of the revisions is, as I've talked a lot about throughout the classes and stuff, the law, especially if you get into the common law level, if you remember our hierarchy way down at the bottom of the common law, things change over what happens, and people in courts interpret different elements. There's also changes in the industry. If you take a look at the 97s, it's the first time that it started talking about green building. And then when you get into the 2007 and then the 2017s, there's actually now an additional form the AIA created, and it's about sustainability, and those are supplemental forms you add to it to attach. So what happens is the AIA as a body monitors the construction industry and takes into consideration what's happening, both changing in the law, the interpretations of what the provisions state, and then ultimately if there are changes in how buildings are built or buildings are designed or what have you. The other thing that will happen is there may be language that they wrote in a or revised in a paragraph that they decided, well, we thought that the law and the direction everything was going in a certain direction, and then the courts ended up interpreting maybe differently than the AIA wanted them to interpret or otherwise, so they'll just tweak some things. And I'll mention a few of those in today's lecture and then in the second half of the semester when we talk about the A201, a couple spots. You won't have to worry about during the exam about is this something new or old or whatever. You're only going to have to know this document. But I just will point out so you can understand the process and what will happen. The other thing that I will say about this document that we're going to go through, this is the clean form that the AIA puts out. That doesn't mean you can't modify it. As I said, there's actually the software's written to have an additions and deletions report on the back end. And in fact, I always modify this document. There are provisions in here whether I represent, sometimes I represent the owner and sometimes I represent the architect. And there's some architect provisions that I want stronger. If I'm representing the architect, I'll make them stronger. If I'm representing the owner, I want to beef up the owner responsibilities and I'll shift some things back onto the architect. So there are reasons why you'll modify the agreement. For your purposes, again, it's just this document, and for the exam purposes, this will also be the document that'll probably, by the time you guys get out and actually take your AREs, if you ever ultimately sit for them, it'll probably be the 27 as opposed to the 17. The changes aren't dramatic, so it's the concepts that we'll be talking about today and next week you should be able to use beneficially for the time you take the exam. Knock on wood, if I'm still teaching then too, you can always go online and find me and then you can see if there's updates to 2017, or the 2027. Because in the first couple of years that I do the lecture, I'll always say, well, in the 17s it said this, now it says this in the 27. So, I'm trying to think anything else from the history. From time to time I will reference things that I will change personally. I'm only doing that because I want to give you a flavor of it. Again, you will not be tested on, Hanahan said he changes this provision. That's not going to be the exam. The exam will be these provisions, this document, and the questions will come straight out of that. So, okay. With that being said, and our goal is to get through at least Article 5. Well, we'll get through Article 5 and see if we can get through Article 6 today. There's 13 articles in it, so I know there's the back end's a little heavier, but there's a lot fewer things to cover as far as substantive information. The document itself is organized into different articles, and each article has a purpose and structurally as far as how you put together. If you want to think about contracts in general, they should have these chunks, and you think about it kind of as you're putting together an outline or if you're writing a paper or whatever, it always helps to have these different chunks, and so it's kind of a roadmap for it. So the beginning of the Article 1 is what's called the initial information, and if you think about it, when a construction project, when an owner wants to build a building, the first thing the owner does after, says, I want to build a building and get some money, is they hire the architect. And so you have to start somewhere. And so the initial information, this is the very beginning of the very beginning of the very beginning of the project. And this initial information will carry over into the construction side as well. So what we have to have in the beginning is it just says, and one of the things also, that contracts sometimes say things that are really simple and really basic, but it's good to have that. Sometimes it's just saying, like the first provision, 1.1, this agreement is based on the initial information set forth in this section 1.1. So you want to think about, as I've said a few times, you want to think about a contract kind of like the rules to playing Monopoly or whatever the game is you're doing. I mean, it's not a game of building construction and things, but are the rules that you have to follow. So it just basically says, hey, this is the initial information. So you want to say the owner's program for the project. The program of the project is, what are you going to build? Well, I'm going to build a 2-bedroom, 3-bath house. I'm going to build a candy factory. I'm going to build a football stadium. The program that I'm outlining. The physical characteristics, and these are just going to be short paragraphs, one or two paragraphs to describe. Sometimes I'll say a $250,000 warehouse that comprised of the following buildings. And you're going to have the main warehouse, the loading docks, the packaging facility, and the guard shack. And that's what's going to be in 1.1.1 and 1.1.2. And then the budget for the cost of the work, and that's the first term I'm going to have highlighted here. We're going to talk about this. It says it's defined in Section 6.1. Now, we'll get there eventually, and I'll show you what it is so you can see how these tie in. At this point, what I want to do is explain a little bit about how contracts are drafted and kind of the rules. We talked somewhat about the rules of contract drafting, but a couple of things so you guys can understand. When you see in a contract a word like owner or project, which are just common nouns, if you see them capitalized, they become what's called a term of art. So what happens is somewhere within this document, the word project is defined. Somewhere in this document, the word owner is defined. Now, if you look at the document that I sent out to you guys in addition, the actual B101, on the very first page, it'll say the owner is, and that's the definition. So instead of having to say, terrible manufacturing of America Inc. every single time. You just identify that as owner, and then it becomes the owner throughout. The same thing for the word project. The project is this, you know, 250,000 square foot factory, blah, 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 blah. So you have these things that are defined. What it allows with contracts, and this is any contract that you're drafting, not just in construction, but any contract, it allows you to shorten things up in a contract. If you have a defined term, and a defined term is a capitalized provision, then you'll know what it is. So we get to this part here in 1.1.3, the cost of the work. Again, you're going to see cost and work as common nouns, but they're capitalized. And I've highlighted it here with italics and bold. Those are not in the document. So anytime you're going to see italics, bold, underlined, or colored on these screens, that's my additions to kind of pull it out for you guys. You can look for them. And when I get to some of these provisions are really lengthy. I'm only going to try to talk about the highlighted stuff, and that's the only part that's going to be potentially a question on the exam. So that's just the way I've set this up for the slide, as opposed to trying to go through the actual provision and saying, well, where is he talking about it? I tried to punch it out for you guys here. So the cost of the work as a defined term is, there's actually two elements in here that you'll want to remember throughout any construction project. The work here is going to be the actual construction of the project. It's not the architect's services. Architects perform services. Contractors provide work. So the cost of the work, and as it says in defined 6.1, and we'll get there in a second, when we get there, I'll show you what it is. The cost of the work is how much it costs to build the facility. It does not include paying me to draft the contracts. It does not include the architect's services fees. So the architect may charge $1 million. That's not included in the cost of the work. But you want to establish this concept of the cost of the work for the owner and for the architect, so they create this budget. If it's going to be $1 million to spend on this strip mall, I got $1 million. If it's going to be $300 million for a candy factory, I have $300 million. You want to establish that in the beginning. Now, what ends up, because remember, this is all initial information. It's all the beginning. And so what's going to happen is an owner's going to come in to the architect, and he's going to be like, the owner's going to say, I want to build a building that does X. It's going to be a clothing store. Levi's wants to build a standalone clothing store for selling their jeans and all their other apparel. Their board of directors, the people that run the company, as we talked about last week, the shareholders, whoever, the people that are running the company, they're going to have budgets to meet, and they're going to have already made a decision. Yes, we want to put up a brand new store in Skokie, a standalone, as opposed to in the mall. Here's our budget for it. Here's how much money you can spend. And that's where this cost of the work comes in. So the owner should normally come to you as the architect and say, I have this much money. If they don't, that's one of the first questions you are asking, because we're talking about the initial information. So you want to figure out how much money the owner has to spend to build it, and then you can design around those parameters. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, this part here, 1.1.4, talks about milestone dates. A milestone date is important times during the course of the project that you and the owner establish, and you want to meet those dates. Now, you've heard this provision, this term before, time is money. And I think I said in an earlier lecture, the most expensive lawsuits where the owner loses the most money is when the project is delayed. Yes, there's problems in times where a wall falls down and you've got to rebuild a wall. And unless it's a catastrophic failure where the whole building catches on fire and collapses or whatever, the costs for those things, of defects, can be expensive. Yes, they can be very expensive. But often, the delay is by far the worst. And so what you want to do is you want to establish these milestone dates. Because like if the project's late, you're going to have a bunch of workers sitting around and you got to pay for them to be there. And you have to pay for storage of the equipment and the materials. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff. You have to pay for insurance. You have to pay for keeping the land going before it starts making revenue. And you're not making revenue, especially if you're building a facility that's supposed to be revenue generating, because you're losing money for your business. So you want to establish these milestone dates. So you have some design milestone dates, and when are you going to get these things done? You want to have construction commencement. When are we going to begin construction, so that means the architect knows the drawings have to be finished in time to start that construction commencement. Substantial completion is the basic end of the project. It's not the final completion, but you see there where it says substantial completion is our defined terms. Those are capitalized, so that becomes a defined term we can talk about later. And then any other milestone dates. And there's other reasons we can go into about why you would have other milestone dates along the way. But for purposes of this agreement, during this initial information phase, a dialogue between the owner and the architect should be, what are important critical dates and what do you need to have done? Most of the time, the architect's going to be one setting those. The owner's going to want to say, I want this factory up and running by October 1st of 2026. And we're in February right now of 2025. The architect's going to say, well, give me the parameters and scope of the facility. You're never going to make it by October of 2026 unless we have to triple hours and, you know, put all these people on the team and everything else because of what you're looking for. So the architect should be able to understand scheduling. There's a whole bunch of things that go into that and can assist the owner on getting realistic dates or how to achieve the dates that the owner wants. So that'll happen in the beginning. Then the owner intends to follow a procurement and delivery method. That's like, is it going to be design build? Is it going to be design bid build? Is it going to be some other alternative delivery? We'll talk about that in another lecture, but this will identify in the project, in the initial information, what's the delivery method. Sometimes, when you're filling this stuff out in the very beginning, the owner may not know. So some of these may be left blank. It's interesting in the AIA, the B101 as a contract, it's got spots for all these things, but sometimes the contract's signed with these left blank, and they're filled in later as the owner learns more, the architect learns more, as information comes in. So that there's a spot for them in the agreement. Questions on that? Okay. First one, stuff that's highlighted here. So 1.1.6 talks about sustainable objectives to the project. As I said, this is new. In the 2007, they talked about specifically sustainability, but they didn't have a specific provision like this one where they actually identify this document called the E204. It's a 2017 document. The AIA recognized at this period of time, they said, hey, people are looking into green buildings and sustainability, and there's LEED, and there's Green Globes, and then, like, if we live here, City of Chicago has its own sustainability requirements to be able to get that. And if you get a LEED building, you could have a certified bronze, silver, gold, platinum, all these other things. You can get tax breaks. There's all these different reasons for going in sustainability. So the AIA said, well, we should recognize that. Let's create a form, and let's create a process for everybody. So this E204 Sustainable Projects Exhibit is the process. It lays out a process by which the owner and the architect in the beginning can talk about sustainability. Now, with every contract you create, and as I told you, I will modify and edit provisions, just because there's a paragraph in here that talks about the E204 and sustainability does not mean the owner must do it. This is going to be a discussion between the owner and the architect. Sustainability costs money. You get money in the back end beneficially, but it costs more money often to do a sustainable building on the front end. So the owner and the architect will discuss that. I would say in the contracts that I do, less than 20% do we exercise this provision. And even if we do exercise this provision, I've only used the E204 once in the last 8 years or whatever it's been since this 2017's been out. It's a cumbersome process that the AIA created. It'll be interesting to see if they change it for the 2027s. And this document, it talks about here, is the owner and the architect shall incorporate the completed E204 into the agreements with consultants and contractors. And so that's why it becomes cumbersome, is because the architect fills out a portion of it, and then the architect goes to their subcontractors, the electrical engineer and the mechanical engineer, and they got to fill out their portion. And then we get the contractor aboard, and they got to fill out their portion. And the contractor's like, I don't want to fill this out. So there's all these steps that go into it. It's a process that I think has logic to it, and it outlines the balance of how things are supposed to be done. But again, it's a little cumbersome. Again, it'll be interesting to see what the 2027s look like on this. Question over here.
Yeah, what would a contractor use for the amount, or is it just like the same one? that.
Well, the contractor may say, well, if you want to do that, then the price is going to be like that, and my bid wasn't based on doing that. You know, there's all these different things, and so depending on, sometimes what will happen is you'll have a contractor you already that you've worked with, and you want to work with that contractor again, so you don't go out to bid, you don't go out and have a competitive bidding process. So that contractor comes in and is like, wait a minute, the last project we did didn't have this, and so why do I have to fill this form out? Now, if you do have a competitive bidding process, you would put the information in and say, anybody that's going to bid is going to also have to fill out the E-204, so you flag that ahead of time. And we'll talk a little bit about bidding and negotiations when we get there in the document. So there's all different reasons why. And then sometimes, like what I said, what I'll do is I'll talk about sustainability. I'll put that they want to have sustainable information. Sometimes they'll even say the architect will help and assist with getting LEED certification, and we'll try to put a goal of bronze or silver or gold or whatever it might be, without using the E-204 documents. You got to remember, before this document came out, LEED has existed since, I think, at least the 70s, maybe in the 60s. So you can get LEED, you can get Green Globes, you can get these different types of sustainable certifications without having to use this form. So sometimes you modify this and say, the owner wants sustainability, but we're not going to use these forms. And then the contractor may work with you on that. So there's different ways to do that. So any other questions on this part? Next one, 1.1.7. The owner identifies the following representative in accordance with Section 5.3. Now, as I talked to you about, the different articles of the document are for different purposes. Article 5, this references 5.3, happens to be the owner's responsibility. So it's a cross-reference. It says, hey, if you look at 5.3, we'll get there. That says the owner has identified this representative. The reason why I've highlighted this is because you want to have one person that's going to be the individual that communicates and says yes or no on behalf of the owner. Sometimes there may be two, but you're going to have someone where you as the architect calls up the owner and says, hey, we're going to make this change and it's going to cost, when you construct this, another $50,000. Are you okay with the design change? And when that representative says yes, you can take it as the agent of the contract approving that request. What you don't want to have happen is not knowing who that person is, and you call up and one person says yes, and then later on when you send the bill for the design and it's bid out and it's so much more expensive, and the owner comes back and says, who gave you authorization for this? Oh, it was Sally. Well, Sally isn't my representative. So this is just a basic, simple thing, but it allows you as the architect to communicate properly with the owner. And that representative will be the one that probably also talks to the contractor as well. So it's just to keep things in line. And the architect's going to have to do the same thing as well. So, yeah.
So in that sentence,
here, the 1.1.7?
Yes.
Yeah.
Representative can be replaced with agents without the cost of buying and making calls.
Are you asking, can I strike the word representative and put the word agent in there? You could, if you want. The term representative for this, and you'll see in 5.3 when we get there, says the representative is acting on behalf of the owner. So by its own definition, when it talks about the representative, it itself is describing an agency relationship. So you can change it if you want, but you need not. And what I would recommend is, because representative is a term used throughout all the suite of the AA documents, because there's owner-contractor documents, there's contractor-subcontractors, there's architect-subconsultants, they use representative consistently. So that was some, and that's something you'll learn as you start to draft the documents. I wouldn't change it myself to agent, because we have a understanding of these documents and what representative means, but it is the same concept there. Okay? All right. I skip 113 or 118. 119 talks about the owner shall retain the following consultants and contractors. Now here it's the owner that's going to retain. Now we'll talk about the services that the architect's going to provide in Article 2, which is coming up shortly. But here, this is a specific statement where it says, you owner have to hire these people, I architect will not. So, geotech engineers, somebody has to come in and do the soil testing to see if it's going to be clay soil or silty soil or rocky soil, whatever it's going to be. That's the owner's responsibility. Civil engineer, remember the story I told you last week or the week before about the subdivision, and at the bottom, it drained into the houses at the bottom of the subdivision, they flooded. That engineer, the civil engineer, which handles sidewalks and streets and laying of the land and the slopes and everything else, that has to be hired by the owner. And so it's the owner's responsibility to bring that in. And then sometimes any other. Maybe you want to have, and this is something that I've had in a number of cases. One of the things that I've done is I've done a lot of hotel developments. And I've worked on hotel developments for like flags, like a Marriott or a Hilton or whatever, so you actually have the flag and they're doing it. Sometimes, though, you're going to have a specialty people, somebody that's building the hotel themselves, they'll partner with the flag, but they want to bring in some star chef, you know, somebody from that's been on Top Chef or something like that. And so they have this signature restaurant in there. And so you might identify over there the restaurant designer. The architect's not going to do the cool whatever is necessary for the restaurant. The architect's going to design that floor and have a box there and it says not in contract, and the architect, the restaurant architect's going to design that. So that may be a consultant or a contractor that the owner brings in. So these you want to identify. Again, these may not be known when the project is first being discussed. So they may be blank, but they'll fill it in as you go along. Question?
Why does the owner have to retain the contractors
and consultants? Why, I believe, the architect is the more, has more knowledge of the way people work? Okay, so the question is why would the owner be the one responsible for having to hire these other type of engineers, these other designers? That's a great question. And there's a couple answers. One, it's kind of been the standard in the industry forever and ever and ever. But the second, what you want to think about is if you look at what geotech is, this is the land that the building's going to be built on. The civil engineer is the land around it and the slope and the topography. The owner comes to the architect and says, here's my plot of land. And the law, as the law interprets as far as ownership rights and everything else, the land always kind of stays in the owner's hands. And so it makes more sense that the owner comes to the project with these things. Now, that's not always the case. I will tell you this. I don't remember if I told you I represented Navy Pier for, 15, almost 20 years. And they did a horizontal renovation, what they called it, of the entire pier, I think for the 2015, their centennial, 2015 or 2016, whatever we opened it. It was the centennial of the Navy Pier, and that's where the big giant Ferris wheel came in. Now we have the second Ferris wheel, and they put all the artware, and they redid the entire pier. They've added a hotel, restaurants. I did all the design, I did all the contracts with the architects for that and for the contractor, so we rebuilt that. And what ended up happening with that is the Navy Pier, if you guys don't know, is built on a series of poles, piles, that are driven down into the lake and everything else. Well, the guy that was running Navy Pier, the one on the construction side, he's like, Mike, I don't want to have, as the owner, any responsibility for the civil, or it's not even geotech because it's sitting on water and down and everything else. So we shifted all of this responsibility to the architect. And so we crossed out the owner and said the architect shall retain this. And then the architect had to hire, and then there was more insurance and everything else. And what turned out is actually that was a benefit, because there was two or three serious problems that came up during the course of it. And we, as the owner, didn't have to carry as much of the cost, because we felt that the architect and their contractor should have caught some of these things. We still had to pay for a certain way to fix it, but the investigation and the cost to have somebody redesign it, that fell onto the architect's team. There was about 15 different firms that worked on the renovation of Navy Pier. So, question?
Yeah. So, are they responsible
Good question, and actually there's a third part to it. So the owner has to look up and find the geotech. So you buy a plot of land, you want to build a house on it. Well, let's take something, because the house, you're maybe not going to have a geotech. Let's say you're going to be putting up a factory, okay? So you're an owner, you have a company, you want to build a new factory, it's the third factory you're building or whatever, and you got this plot of land. So the owner has to go out and search and find geotech engineers that do the soil, they do these cores, they bore down and they bring up a core sample and they test it for the type of dirt and the type of compaction levels and everything else. So the owner has to, A, find that geotech engineer, hire and schedule where that geotech engineer is going to come out to the site, pay for that geotech engineer, And then if there are mistakes or there are errors, the owner has to own those costs. So it's an interesting question when you go in, and that's why maybe Pier wanted to shift the responsibilities off of that. I had another project where I represented United Airlines. United Airlines had a terminal out in the East Coast. It was a aircraft. It wasn't a hangar. Well, it was kind of a hangar, but it was where they would bring planes in for to fix. It was where they bring in mechanics or whatever. So they had this huge space. You had to bring in an airplane in, and they had different machine shops and everything else, and that's where they would fix it. And what happened was, is United hired a design-build firm and shifted the responsibilities for all of the soil samples and everything else to this design-build firm. And it turned out that there was one part of the soil that was silty soil and everything else, and the engineer that was hired by the conglomerate of the architect recommended a certain type of process and these different silt things and different way they dig the holes and then they put in the different materials and then they backfill and they compact it and everything else. And that was all supposed to be done. It wasn't done properly, and it ended up happening is that the corner started sinking, and so when you brought a plane in, it was like kind of crooked. And so we had a big lawsuit on that, and one of the provisions we came back into was the contract, and it was not an AA contract. It was United's form agreements, which are based on this, but they had some of this language. And we went in and sorted out who was responsible for what. So whoever hires that engineer will be responsible for their mistakes. You have another question, Paul? Sure.
I understand the transfer of decision between the owner and the architect.
Yes.
But I guess fundamentally, why the owner and the architect presumably don't have enough knowledge in the field should be responsible? And second question, when these people have the results of the test, do they give it directly to the owner or to the architect?
Great questions, both of them. So let's take the second one first. The geotech information, depending on the sequencing of the project, sometimes the owner goes to the architect and he has no idea, and the architect says, go out and hire a geotech, and then the borings and the soil samples come back, and they provide it, you ask that geotech to give it to both you and the architect at the same time. Sometimes the owner may be sophisticated, the developer has done this before, and comes to the architect, but the architect must have this information because they still need to understand what the soil is, because the architect is going to design the footings. They're going to design how the construction is. So there's ultimately going to be information in that the architect uses. So regardless of whether the geotech gives it to the owner, it has to get into the hands of the architect. So that's that question. The other question, which is a really good one too, is about why is the owner responsible? And the way it looks like is you want to think about, again, if we remember we talked about the triangle. It really should create like a slide in my very first lecture about the triangle. You can see the solid lines. It comes up later, like left late in the semester, but I should change it. The solid lines create a contract. The dotted lines, there's no contracts, okay? So you have a contract in this instance between top is the owner of the triangle and the two bottom corners, the architect and the contractor. There's going to be an offshoot over here with of the triangle, like an arm coming across with the geotech engineer, and there's going to be a solid line there. So when something goes wrong with that, the owner is responsible in the sense of neither the other two people in the traditional triangle, the architect or the contractor, have to pay for it. The owner still can sue the geotech for its breach, and the geotech ultimately would be responsible for that. But there's always limits on that because the way geotech engineers do stuff, their contracts are very one-sided. And so what ends up happening is the geotech's like, I'm only responsible just a little bit because I only took like this many soil samples. And so then the cost will come down. And sometimes the geotech pays, but sometimes the owner has to. So the responsibility is arguably ultimately should be the geotech's. But depending on the terms of that argument or that agreement, more may fall back on the owner. The reason why the owner slash geotech in that branch, but that branch is responsible, is because the provision has put the responsibility there. But certainly we know that the architect and the contractor at the bottom are not responsible because this says the owner shall. Does that make sense? Remember, this is a document that's between you and the architect. So the architect is providing parameters and boundaries saying, I'm not responsible for these things. You are. However you deal with that is your issue. You enter into contract with somebody else. If the civil engineer screws up, you sue them, but you can't sue me because I'm not responsible. You are, in whatever manner that might be. So there has to be a good argument, a good agreement between owner and civil engineer, a good agreement between owner and the geotech, or between owner and kitchen designer, whoever that might be.
So if a building is a bad building, it's not functional. then the argument says, oh, it was a geotech person that gave all the wrong information and made it wrong. Then that would go to court and things would be investigated to see if it's an architectural problem or if it's a geotech decision.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, that's the discovery, the investigation to see who's responsible for it. And that's what I do. Because everybody's doing this. Everybody's pointing their fingers at each other. Not me, it was them. Not me, it was them. It's not me. Everybody's doing not me, not me, not me. You know, as opposed to like, I always laugh when I think about when I'm in lawsuits where there's multiple parties and I think about Donkey and Shrek jumping up back going, pick me, pick me, pick me. It's not that way. It's the opposite. It's not me. It's not me. It's not me. That's the law. Unfortunately, that's what happens. And so, and what you'll find out also sometimes, and you'll see this coming up in a provision, is maybe that the geotech stuff is so egregiously wrong that the architect should have known it. Like, hello, there's a swamp out there and you're telling me that soil's fine. I know it's not right, so the architect should raise his hand, and we'll get to those provisions coming up. So sometimes they pointing fingers at each other is actually correct because it's like, you should have known this. Like, you can't completely absolve yourself if you're looking at this swamp here and you ignored it. So, okay. 1.1.10, the architect identifies the following representatives. So just like the owner, the architect should have a single person. You want the single point. So when the owner talks to someone, only one person that the owner gives approval to is the one to do that. The owner shouldn't be talking to the seconds or the thirds or whatever on the site and then all this other stuff. All the communication should flow through the single identified representative. That's very important because they are the agent for the contract for each party. Okay? Now, under 1.1.11, now we have the similar to 1.1.9, the architect shall retain the consultants identified, and we have a list of consultants. So what you're going to find in contracts, especially in construction contracts, are like, well, the owner has to do this, and the architect has to do this. Owner this, architect, owner, architect. So that's what we have here. Now, what we have here under basic services, again, this is a capitalized term. Remember, work is construction. Services is the architects, what the architect's providing. Is the architect's going to provide structural, mechanical, and electrical. Now, sometimes the architect will do that in-house, if they have that team, those people on their team. But sometimes a smaller architect may go out and hire a separate structural engineer, a separate mechanical engineer. So under basic services, these are the three things, in addition to the architectural design, the making it pretty, these are the three things that the architect must retain. This is traditional. This is standard in the industry for ever. So. There are no questions that are silly. Just I want to say that. And anybody here, there's no such thing as a silly question. Just want you to know that. And then you had a question here.
If the owner and architect are the same person, would that person still write all these things for themselves?
I mean, if I'm an architect and I'm building my own house, no, you just design it and build it, and you make sure you get the building permits, and you have a good. You would have a contract between owner and contractor, and that you would say what the drawings are coming from you, but you would not. You don't have to enter into a contract with yourself. So, that's not a silly question, though. I mean, especially because if you have an individual and they have a company, like that whole issue that I talked about, the company's not going to enter into a contract with an individual. It's just, that won't happen. Because if you think about it, you're not going to sue yourself.
Yeah.
So that's the one part. Like, oh my God, I'm going to sue my company because my building's falling down. No, I don't want to do that. So.
But if the
owner/architect
is using his company, people, and facility, then there should be a
contract. I'm confused by your question. So if I'm an architect and I'm building my new office, and I got a plot of land and I design a building and then I hire a contractor to build that building, and I'm going to have my people, because I'm working in an office where we're renting, and we're going to move all of our staff and everybody else there, and we're all going to work out of there. That's your question. Should there be a contract between me as the individual and the company? No. There wouldn't be a contract there. Because the individuals working for you, they're going to sue the company if the wall falls down or the building or somebody gets hurt. But you just want to make sure, because what's going to happen? I mean, much more than 99 times out of 100, the architect is going to be on site and will understand what's going on. I have a number, obviously I represented and have known a number of architects over my 30 plus years of being a lawyer, and the ones that I know that have designed buildings are very actively involved, and so they are going to watch things, and they're going to be the ones that are going to keep the contractor in line, and those are some of the best buildings that come out. I mean, I guess you could find an architect to screw up its own building, but they're going to want to follow it much more closely because it's their own. I wouldn't expect you're going to find architectural or structural issues with somebody designing their own building. I guess it could happen, but you don't need a contract between an owner and the designer, because again, if somebody gets hurt in that facility, they're just going to sue the company, and what is the company going to do? Sue the owner? So it's just the company and the owner still the same thing for that purposes. So, you had a question up here.
What is a civil engineer?
From up here? Civil engineers, the slope of the land and the grading, sewer systems, it's going to make sure, so like if you're on, to make sure that everything drains properly, to make sure that not just sewer, but water, other different types of piping that comes in, and they're the ones that are going to work with the city to bring in, so there's gas lines and stuff, they're going to be handling a lot of underground and then flow of the traffic and flow of the water and stuff like that. That's what a civil engineer does. On a very basic level. They do a lot more, but that's a basic level. Question?
This video has also come out of the investigation, but if the architect hires like a mechanical engineer, the mechanical engineer is not very good, and then if they mess something up, and the owner is the architect, would the architect then point fingers at their mechanical engineer? But
yes.
Also,
yeah.
How would that responsibility be distributed? Because they're the ones that hire.
So here's what happens with that, and that's a great question. That's the structure of how a lawsuit would happen. And so just for anybody that isn't sure what they do, structural engineer make sure the building doesn't fall. This is very basic. This is like 30,000 feet. Structural engineer, building doesn't fall down. Mechanical engineer, HVAC systems, those types of things. Electrical engineering, lighting, plugs, electrical throughout. Okay, so mechanical engineer you're going to think about is the one that's going to design, make sure the airflow comes in. Okay, so let's say what happens is you have somebody, you hire an architect to design your house. And it's a very nice big house and everything else, and I can tell you this from my own personal experience, we have a furnace in the basement, we have a furnace in the attic. The furnace in the attic, and I'm going to change it a little bit, but our furnace in the attic over a period of time, because it's both the furnace and it's where, because it's the HVAC, it's also the air conditioner. So we have a big air conditioner fan outside the front and everything else, but it has to go through the furnace system, and there's a condenser unit up there. And here's what's kind of wild, I didn't even know this. So all of a sudden, it's in the middle of July, and it was 100 degrees outside, and there started to be leaking into our hallway upstairs. I'm like, it's not raining. Why is it leaking? Well, what ended up happening is when you have an air conditioner running, there's a condenser unit, and that condenser unit froze. So while it's 100 degrees outside, probably 120 in the attic, that thing froze solid, so the air conditioning system didn't work properly. And so when the water was leaking, it was flooding into a pan and overflowed in the pan, and then it started leaking down into the house. So that was a problem with our house, and that was because it wasn't because of a design problem, it's just because our furnace was old. But I have had a case where that exact same thing happened, where it was a design problem. It didn't design the condenser unit properly. It was the wrong size, and it was leaking into my client's bedroom. And so they were lying in bed, and it was dripping down on their face. Swear to God, this exactly happened. It was a brand new house. They had been in the house for a week, and it was in the middle of the summer, and it was leaking on their face because they had just moved in. So, not really happy. So there was a whole bunch of other problems that happened with this house, but ultimately when we sued the architect because the owner had the contract with the architect sued the mechanical engineer. And then we also sued the contractor because there was a question of, was it designed right or was it built right? And it was a combination of both. So we sued the contractor and said, you're also responsible for the water leaking on my face, and they sued their mechanical contractor. So we had a mechanical engineer, we had a mechanical contractor. The owner sued and was going to collect from the architect. They don't care if the architect can collect from the mechanical engineer, and I don't care if the contractor can collect from the mechanical contractor. I collect from the contractor, and I collect from the owner the architect on behalf of the owner.
Did they sue the mechanical engineer
for the same amount? Yes. Yeah, the contractor was like, We don't do anything. We're just a general contractor. We don't build anything. It's all your responsibility. So that's what happens. And architects can do the same thing. We didn't design it. You designed it. So it's all about pushing the buck down. And they'll have you as architects will have those agreements with your subcontractors that say, if you design this, you're responsible for it. And that's fine. That's just normal contracting. I mean, that's not something. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, if you think about it, a normal architect that's just building houses and everything doesn't have to have all this specialized knowledge. In fact, why would you want to? If you're going to be building a complex building, why wouldn't you want to hire a specialist structural engineer or a specialist mechanical engineer or electrical engineer? And shift that too. Go ahead. Yes. Yes. Very different. It's a very different discipline. So, another question.
The previous example of this entourage was
Yes, yes, yes.
Do they go to the same course?
Yes.
What do they all mean in the same city?
There's all these rules about what's called venue and joinder, and there's all this other stuff, and we can talk about that. I don't want to do that today because we've got so much stuff to cover. But yes, you eventually have to try to get everybody in court. There are problems. Sometimes you can't get people into court. There's subpoena powers. There's a whole bunch of other stuff. But the goal is to try to get everybody under one forum. And sometimes that even becomes a strategy. I don't want to be in state court. I want to be in federal court. I don't want to be in federal court. I want to be in arbitration. So there's all these strategy that comes in when the contracts are being put together. So, okay. Moving on, let's go to 1.2. The owner and the architect may rely on the initial information. They both can rely on it, meaning whatever you put in here, I believe you. My budget is this, the building needs this many buildings or whatever. The initial information may materially change. I realized I need just not one loading dock, I need two loading docks. Well, that's a whole new piece that I got to add. I realized that somewhere along the lines, I went from, while we were building this house, I ended up getting married, and my new wife had three kids of her own, so we need to add three more bedrooms. There may be changes to the design. And in that event, the owner and the architect shall appropriately adjust the services, the schedule, and compensation. If you're going to change your program, I should get paid for it as the architect, and I shouldn't have to hit the dates that we had decided earlier. If it was a two-bedroom, three-bath house, and now it's going to be a five-bedroom, six-bath house, I got to have a little more time to design. I got to redesign, and it's going to cost me more money, so you have to pay for that. So basic, simple stuff, but it's important that we write it down. Sometimes you're going to find provisions like this in the contract. They're like, well, of course, if you're going to change the building, I should get paid for it. And of course, I should get more time. Well, somewhere along the lines, there was a bunch of lawsuits about this. Maybe with a little bit of time, maybe there's an argument of whether it's a material change or not. And so the AAA said, let's stick a paragraph in that says what you have to do if you change it. So it's basic, but it covers it. And that's where provisions are added. Every 10 years, we're going to add provisions, we're going to take provisions away as the process of the law has changed. My guess is this provision has been in for decades, but it's something that you can understand why it's there. Yeah, you do what's called a change order or an add services, and you write it all down, and you say paragraph 3.2 is changed from this to this, and paragraph 4.5 is changed from this to this, and so you do that addition. It's sort of a supplemental document, and you say in that this is now incorporated in the full contract. You do not rewrite the whole contract. That's a good question. Okay, 1.3. The party shall agree on the protocol governing the transmission and use of the instruments of service. Now, here's a document, or here's another term, instruments of service, that's capitalized. I'll explain that in a second. This uses what's called the E304. Remember we had that E203. Remember we had the E204 that was on sustainability? The E203 is about what happens when you're transferring documents electronically. If I'm going to be using some type of BIM process or a Revit or whatever I'm going to be using and I'm changing and transferring documents, there could be a degradation in the data. And so it comes back when I get the document that maybe the document that was sent to me, some layer, if you guys designed enough, you design in layers and everything else, one of the layers may not have translated. We never know what's going to happen in the data transmission. So these are documents that allow for what happens if. Now, I have another document that I use instead of using the E203. Other firms use that, but the whole concept here is to protect yourself if there's data issues. Now, going back to this thing, instruments of service. So we get to Article 7, which will be next week. We'll talk about it in more detail. But the instruments of service, for your understanding really quickly, is your draw. This is from the architect creates the instruments of service. It's your drawings, your specifications, isometrics, axonometrics, sketches, renderings, models, all the things that you create that allow the building to be constructed. They're your services. It's the instruments that you have created to build the building. I don't know who thought of the name, but that's what it is. And it includes drawing specs, all these other things that everybody's going to use. So that's a defined term. And you'll see that over and over and over, whether it's an AIA document or not. Everybody knows in the industry what the instruments of services are. Okay? All right, that's all the initial information. Now we're going to get to Article 2, the architect's responsibility. So now we're going to do architect is 2, and then 3 is going to talk about the services. Eventually, when we get to 5, will be the owner services. So the architect's responsibility shall provide professional services, because remember, you're a professional. Professional services as set forth in this agreement. Only what's in this agreement, not some other outside stuff. So you want to incorporate everything that you're going to do, and we all know both sides' responsibilities. It's within what they call the four corners of the contract. That's what is in this agreement. You got to be properly licensed, and you're going to provide services that are required by this agreement. So you got to say, hey, I'm licensed in the area. And that's okay. I'm licensed in the state of Illinois, I'm licensed in California, wherever it might be. So you must make that representation, because God forbid you're designing in a place where you're not licensed, or maybe your company's not licensed and you get in the lawsuit and then you have to give your money back. So, which happened to, like I said, my client. Okay. 2.2. This one's highlighted in blue only because it's probably one of the most important things you guys are going to see and what your job is. Now, I think I talked a little bit about contractors guarantee their work. Architects do not guarantee their work. Their services. Architects perform to what's called a standard of care. That's what you're held against. And so what ends up happening is that's where the battle of the experts are. The standard of care for the design of these types of services is X. The other side says, no, it's Y. And it's a subjective concept. And so what we have here is the architect, and I've said this a couple times in the past, but I'm going to say it again here, because it's now in the contract, shall perform a service consistent with the professional, because you're a professional, skill and care, ordinarily, not extraordinary, you're just an ordinary architect, that's it. You're not an extraordinary architect, you're an ordinary architect, ordinarily provided the architect's practicing in the same or similar locality, so the area, like you're not going to be designing in California a building that has to have earthquakes here in Illinois. You're going to be designing for what's traditional for Illinois, or if you're designing in California, vice versa. Same locality under the same or similar circumstances. This is the site. It's going to be farmland. It's going to be on a beach. It's going to be in a city. So those are the locations and everything else, the area. And then it says, the architectural performance services as expeditiously as consistent with such professional skill and care. So you have to do it timely. So this is the standard that you're held to. This is called the standard of care. 2.2 will always be what you're judged by. Now, what sometimes may happen is sometimes they may say the highest, professional highest skill and care. Like I have, I had a couple of contracts where we were working on the restarting of a nuclear power plant up in Canada. And so we put in there that the engineers working on the restarting, it wasn't a design, it had already been built, but it was shut down, but we had to bring in engineers to work on some of the design parts to get it restarted. We put in the highest skill and care because we wanted to make sure we got the best of the best. So, but this is here, it's just ordinary. You're just an ordinary architect working in the same area, in the same type. So you're going to be like, if I'm a hospital architect, I'm designing hospitals like an ordinary hospital architect. If I'm doing a candy factory, it's like an ordinary candy factory architect. Those types of things. Okay? Any questions on that? And the standard of care is going to come out, and you're going to see that provision, or very close to that provision, in almost every one of your contracts. I would recommend also, sometimes architects want to keep that out, I would recommend if you're drafting your own agreement, you still put that in, so we establish what it is. So the last thing you want to do is have it silent, and then the owner come back and say, well, I thought you were going to give me the highest level of care. So you have to work with that. Okay. Architect shall representative authorized, and this is where, remember it said in the initial information, the representative is the name Beth Jones. That's what we put in the initial information. Well, Beth Jones is going to be put here too. It's the same thing, and it's going to be say authorized to act on behalf of the architect. That's your agency language. And in 5.3, which is the owner section, it's the same language. The owner shall, representative shall be Tom Jones or Tom Smith, whatever it is, and authorized to act on behalf of the owner. So this is the agency language that you're looking for. It's just to repeat, this is specifically creating the agency. Initial information is just information. Okay? 2.4, except for the owner's knowledge and consent, the architect shall not engage in any activity or accept any employment list that would reasonably appear to compromise the architect's professional judgment. If the owner tells the architect, I want you to design and to do this way, and the architect's like, I don't think we can structurally do that, or I don't think that feels right the way we do it, oh, just go ahead and do it, like, we want to save money, use this steel instead of that steel, whatever it is. If the contractor does the same thing, if somebody else is trying to change what is your professional judgment, you can't do it here, because if it's reasonably going to compromise your professional decision, that puts you at risk. So you want to have this language in here to protect yourself. And you can say to the owner, well, I just can't use that steel because our agreement says I can't have my professional judgment compromised. This actually helps you, this language, to protect you. So, question here.
So, kind of connecting that back to 2.2 a little bit, so where it says in there, services
make
initially consistent with such professional skill and care. Yeah. I think that could be thought of as like, okay, as an architect, you need to be timely, but at the same time, it could also be kind of a defense too, where like a client or someone could not, like there is a certain amount of time that it takes to do work that is up to the standard of skill and care.
Correct, yeah.
And then like,
yeah.
Just because they're demanding, I guess.
To make you speed up so they can get their factory running faster so they can go online and make money. That's exactly right. The architect still needs to hold true to their professional requirements. And what may end up happening is you may have to go back to the owner and say, I need more time to design this the way you want it to be. Now, the owner may come back and say, but you created the schedule. You were the professional. I went to you as a subject matter expert. You told me it was going to be 18 weeks of design. Now you're asking for 20 weeks. And you're going to say, do you want it, your building compromised? And so what ends up happening a lot of times in that situation is you get the 20 weeks and you don't get penalized for it as the architect. The owner doesn't charge you if the project comes in late, but maybe the owner doesn't pay you for those 2 weeks. Sometimes you may get paid for 1 week. There's all these different things. If you can prove as the architect that the program changed and that's why you need more time, then you can get more money. So there's all these kind of negotiations that happen as a result of that, but you are correct. You want to make sure that you are not compromising your professional performance. So, okay, 2.5. The architect shall maintain the following insurance until the termination of this agreement. I'm going to blow through this really quickly because 2 weeks from now we're going to do insurance, but there are types of insurance that the owner wants to make sure that you carry. I'm not going to define any of them. We'll talk about them next in 2 weeks. But you're going to need to do commercial general liability insurance, automotive liability insurance, excess or umbrella policy, workers' comp, employer's liability, and the most important one for you guys is professional liability. Professional liability in 2.5.6, the one I will tell you, is your malpractice insurance. So when the architect gets sued because the wall fell down and the building was done improperly, or even if the architect was delayed and late in providing the drawings, the professional liability is the one that you go after. All the other ones are, unless there's a car accident on site, that would be the auto liability. But if anything has to do with the design and the services provided by the architect, that's professional liability. And as I said, we'll go into that more detail in a couple weeks. And then any additional insurance, you may have to provide information on that. We'll talk about that in another one. But the purpose of this provision of 2.5 is the owner wants to make sure that not only is the architect competent, not only is the architect being professional, and not only is the architect licensed, but if something goes wrong and I have to sue the architect, there's an insurance company behind that's going to pay for my losses. Because most architects aren't going to be running capital rich, and if you have a multi-million dollar failure or loss, the architect probably doesn't have that money. So you want to have the insurance in place. So, okay. Any other questions on the architect's services at the high level? Great. Okay, Article 3 then talks about the scopes of the basic services. Now we're going to talk about in Article 4 what's called additional and supplemental services, but these are the basic services that all architects are going to provide under this agreement. The architect may potentially provide no supplemental services or no additional services, which are two different things. We'll explain that. But they will provide for whatever you're paying them. For $10,000, I want you to design my house. For the $10,000, everything in Article 3, you're going to get from the architect. Those are the basic services. Okay? So, basic services consisted of the usual and customary. I mean, remember, we talked about those three that we already had. Well, they've even gone so far as to say it's usual and customary. Structural, mechanical, and electrical. Services not set forth in this Article 3 are supplemental and additional. So if it's not written in Article 3, it's extra. And that's good. That's good for you because it helps define what you have to give as basic, but extra means you can get more money. So what ends up happening is they come in and say three bedroom, two bath house, whatever it might be, and your basic services, and then the owner says, I want you to give me an upgraded lighting system, or I want you to handle the, I want a really cool, in the basement, I want the theater room. Well, all that's going to be additional services or supplemental services, so it's not in the basic because it's upgraded HVAC, it's upgraded low voltage, all these other things that weren't in the basic three-bedroom, two-bath house. So, 3.1.2, the architect shall coordinate its services with those services provided by the owner and the owner's consultants. Let me finish this point real quick and then I'll get you a question. So remember I've represented a number of hotels where they bring in the specialty architect to design the restaurant. That would be the owner's consultants that come in. And so the architect's like, I'm designing the building here. I need to make sure that there's a space for the owner's architect for the restaurant to come in. And I have to work in conjunction with them with where the plugs are going to go and how the electrical is going to work and the HVAC. So that's what that means. Question? Yeah.
I know the
architect
does their architect, but also lighting designer.
Yes.
So it's supposed to be a system for a project. Would they consider both their architect slash lighting designer as a basic service, or would it be the architect as a basic service, and then if they would offer the lighting design, would offer it as a supplemental service?
It's a great question, and as my favorite you'll hear all throughout the year is, it depends. So sometimes what happens is you have an architectural firm, the way it's structured and set up is that they say, they'll modify this and say that the case we include structural, mechanical, electrical, and specialty lighting, and they'll create that as the basic services. Another architectural firm may have two different departments. Because they've set up the departments, they have two different accounting systems. Because sometimes somebody just hires them for only the lighting design in an existing building, or a lot of architectural firms will have an interior design branch. Sometimes that interior design branch you will have a separate contract with. Sometimes the interior design branch will be a subconsultant under the architect. So there's all different ways business-wise of how to structure it. And the owner, what you're going to say is, whether it's a basic service or a supplemental services, I'm going to make sure that this one document that I have with you, architect, specifically details who's responsible for what. So it may be listed under basic, it may be listed under supplemental, it may be listed there, but we have to say who's doing it and who's responsible and how it's going to get paid for it. So when the thing goes wrong, the owner only looks to the architect. Again, the owner wants to have single point responsibility, and how the architect handles it internally, that's their issue. So it could be specific, it could be in and out. It just depends on what a lot of times it just depends on the business structure the architect's going to do. And I've seen it all different ways. Okay, so with the coordination of the services, the architect shall be entitled to rely on and shall not be responsible for the accuracy, completeness, and timeliness of the services and information furnished by the owner and the owner's consultants. So I'm designing this hotel, and I know that we got to get this hotel up and running and open. The construction needs to start on the hotel June 1st of 2025. So I'm fiercely designing right now, and I know that the owner wants to bring in this architect that's going to do this restaurant. And so I leave this box in the floor plan, and it says, here's where it's going to be. And the architect is too busy, and he's got other work going on elsewhere, blah, 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 blah. And they're late on the drawings. I, as the architect, am not responsible for that. I coordinated with them. I've given the information. But, owner, that's your problem. So if your consultant is late, you can't charge me. Or if the architect gives this floor plan and says, and it's timely, and says, here's where all my materials and kitchens are going to be. I need this HVAC for my hoods and exhaust vents. I need this type of fire protection system. I need this electrical. I need this lighting. All these other things that I need, plumbing, whatever it is, to make sure that my systems operate for my kitchen. And you design for that. You make sure all the plugs and all the connections are right there for your design. And it turns out that the architect is wrong. Well, you are entitled as the architect to rely on and not responsible for the accuracy. So again, if the architect does something wrong, you as the architect says, it's not my fault. I had their drawings. I followed exactly what they asked me to do. You have to pay for whatever the cost is, owner, and you chase after your architect for that. So it's not, the owner will pay, but the architect doesn't pay, and the owner has to fight it out with their own separate person. Okay? So that's pretty much a protection provision for you. 3.1.3. So this talks about the schedule that you're going to create. So you're going to work with the owner on the schedule of when the design is going to be done. In the middle it says the schedule initially shall include anticipated dates for the commencement of construction when you begin and for substantial completion. Again, you can see that's one of those defined terms. Substantial completion, it's ultimately defined in the A201. I'll just give you the basic of it. Substantial completion of the building is when it can be used for its intended fit and purposes. If it's a house, I can live in the house. If it's a factory, I can make my candy. If it's a football stadium, I can have a football game and the fans can come in. Not everything is finished. There's punch list items and there's all this stuff that's still being done, but it operates as what's intended. That's substantial completion. Very important in both a legal term and money and release of funds and other stuff. But you want to identify the anticipated dates. Now, they may move because you're just in the beginning. I mean, you haven't even put pencil to paper yet when you're signing this contract, but at least you're putting something down. And then you're going to look for approval of that, and then it says later down, it says, once approved by the owner, time limits established by the schedule shall not, except for reasonable cause, be exceeded by the architect or owner. So we have this, and the owner has their own dates that they have to get. Like the architect has to get the information by this date, or I have to get the soil samples by this date, or I have to get something from the city by this date. So the owner has their own responsibilities. So there's this part here where they say, we're locking in the schedule, and unless there's something reasonable that changes, both of us have to follow the schedule. And if neither of us, if one of us doesn't, that's their problem, and they have to pick up the cost for those. Make sense? 3.1.4, the architect shall not be responsible for the owner's directive or substitution or for the owner's acceptance of non-conforming work made or given without the architect's written approval. So this is a provision that came in the last two revisions of the document. Owners love to come on project sites and love to change things. And owners love to talk to contractors and say, oh, you can do this while you're doing it because they're the ones building it. Why don't you move this? Can you move this duct system? Can you do this? Can you do that? If the owner does that, the owner accepts non-conforming work, here's your money, contractor, I accept it, it looks fine, but it wasn't built as designed, architect's not responsible. The architect's like, unless the architect knew that it wasn't built as designed, but if the architect said, well, owner, you accepted it, you looked at it, you said it was fine, I'm not responsible that the contractor didn't build it right. You had a contract with the contractor, you should have enforced that. Or if you told the contractor, move this light from here to there, I'm not responsible for that because you did that without telling me. So this is about communication as much as anything else. One of the things that, as lawyers, I'm going to say to you is write it all down. That way I can track what happened on the project. What happens on the worst projects as far as the legal side of it is people don't write stuff down. They don't keep track. They're talking to Bob. They're talking to Joe. It's a crappy email. It's not very clear. Oh, yeah, we took care of all that stuff that you asked me to do, and the email will say that. Here's my bill. They're like, what does that mean? So this is where you're trying to hear the architect kind of saying, raise your hand, saying, don't do this without me knowing. And if you do, I'm not responsible for it. Okay? 315. This is government authorities, so there's issues where you like have to get permits and stuff, and the architect shall respond to applicable design requirements imposed by those authorities and entities. Basically, what this is saying is, if I have to have, let's say I'm building in the city, and I have to have a curb cut at a certain spot, because that's where the city allows me to do a curb cut. Or if I have to have a setback, whether it's a setback at street level or as you go higher in a high rise because of the air and everything else, I need to follow what the responsibilities and requirements of the governmental authorities. And so this is one area where the architect, while it's not necessarily written in the program, owner comes to me as architect and says, hey, I want to build a 30-story condo building in downtown Chicago. And I want this stuff and that stuff. It's going to have a spa. It's going to have, you know, a garage. It's going to have these types of units, some single or some one-bedroom, two-bedroom, three-bedroom. You give them all that program and stuff. The owner's not going to say, oh, and by the way, after 40 feet, you have to have a 3-foot setback. Or there's all these things that are required when you build that follow building codes or other type of regulations. Owner's not going to know any of that. You are. And that's your responsibility, is to make sure you communicate where's that curb cut, where are the setbacks, where whatever you need to do. So you're communicating, where is the building permits right, all these types of things. Am I in the right zoning? Those are the information that the architect has to reach out for. Okay? 316. The architect shall assist the owner in connections with the owner's responsibility of filing documents required for approval of government authorities. If I, owner, have to get a building permit, I don't know where to go. So I'm going to call up the architect, and the architect's going to help me. Either come with me, they're going to file it for me for a fee. The architect gets paid for having to file that. But they help the owner because the architect does this every day. The owner doesn't. So it's a simple just communication. But again, it's a provision that if it was silent, if there was nothing in here, then later down the road when the permit's not there and the contractor's like, where's my building permit? Owner and architect can be pointing fingers at each other. So now we know who does what. You're going to assist the owner. Yes, question.
Do you think the architect will get paid for the filing of the labor of
figuring
government?
Yeah, if you have to fill out a form and you have to call the government agents and see and then go to meetings, you're going to bill for your time there. Everything, like as architects, you bill on an hourly rate, so you're going to bill time for that. It's the same thing, like if I'm designing, I'm going to bill for my time designing. Well, it's the same thing. You're doing services to get this building built, so that's what you get paid for. That's what I mean by that. And that will normally be built into the budget that the architect provides. It's going to probably cost around this much money, etc. Second half of the semester, we're going to talk about that whole budget thing and how you price out a project, and so that'll be built into that. Okay. Section 3.2, schematic design. So there's different phases in the design world. You probably know them, but I'm going to say them now. Sometimes there's pre-design and earlier like brainstorming and stuff, but for the basic services you're going to think about here, there's schematic design, there's design development, and then there's the construction document phase. Those are your three main phases in basic services for every architect. Schematic design comes first, and it's going to kind of describe what you have to do and what you're going to provide for the owner. So everybody has an understanding, at the end of this phase, what am I going to get? So the architect's going to review the program that was up in the initial information, and they're going to review the laws and codes that we just talked about. They're going to make sure what the setbacks and everything is applicable. So your job is to make sure you do a little bit of your homework. Oh, here's what the project's going to be in my schematic design. I'm going to make sure I'm building and designing everything that the owner's asking for, and I'm building it within the laws and regs. 3.2.2. The architect shall prepare a preliminary evaluation of the owner's program, so their own like write-up. The owner's like, hey, I just want to do this factory with these three buildings, and the architect's going to kind of say, well, you really need is this, this, and this. They're going to give you a budget for the cost of the work. The project site they're going to prepare a preliminary evaluation of, and the proposed procurement and delivery methods. So let's talk about these couple things here. Oh, with schedule as well. I forgot schedule. Budget for the cost of the work. So there's budgets and there's estimates. Now, at the very beginning, there's one thing that I did incorrectly here. Prepare a preliminary evaluation of the owner. So the owner should have given all the things: program, schedule, budget, cost, project site, the information. This is all the information the owner's providing. Okay, it's not what the architect has provided. The architect's doing the preliminary evaluation of what the owner has provided them in these things. What you want to understand is, and this will be, I just kind of think about this because there'll probably be a question in the test for it. Owner, budget. Architect, estimate. Architect never provides a budget. Architect only provides an estimate. Owner takes that estimate and uses it to create the budget. Budget is how much I have to spend. Estimate is how much we think it will cost you. Architects never give budgets. Owners do. So when you talk about here the budget, the cost of the work, this is when the owner says, I got $1 million to build this house. This is what I got to spend. And the architect later will create an estimate for it. Here's my project site, and here's my soil samples. The architect's going to review those and say, I need more soil samples, or I think this is what's going to happen with your foundation, or what have you. So this is all preliminary. It's all in the early stages, okay? And then the architect shall notify the owner of, one, any inconsistencies discovered with the information, and two, other information or consulting services that may be reasonably needed for the project. Hey, I've got your soil samples. I went out to the project site. I took a look at it. It doesn't match the soil samples. It's a big lot, and it looks like some of the areas where the soil samples are fine and has integrity, but where your building is going to be a swampland, and that's not shown in your soil survey. We need to get that area surveyed. That's a kind of a dramatic change of what, you know, like that's really an exaggeration of what would happen. But if you see stuff, if you're the architect, like one of the things when you get the survey back, it should show, like, where if there's, and the geotech may have to do this, or somebody else may have, the civil engineer may have to do this, is like if it's an existing property that where a building has been raised, well, underneath there probably is going to be existing gas lines or water lines or stuff you can't see, phone lines. And so that civil engineer or the geotech engineer is going to be the one that's going to go back in and try to find that information. And if the architect walks out on the site and says, hey, I saw this pipe sticking up, and it looks like it's part of an old sewer system, it's not on the information you provided me, we need to have this site resurveyed. So that's what's going to happen under this preliminary schematic design phase under 322. 322, 323. The architect shall present its preliminary allegation to evaluations of the owner, and the architect shall reach an understanding with the owner regarding the requirements of the project. So they're going to say, this is what I think you want, here's all the information you gave me, and this is what I'm going to give to you. Does this make sense? This is refining the program, detailing it so we're all on the same page. This may take a lot of time back and forth because you as the specialist, the professional, are going to be telling things to the owner that they didn't even think about. That's why they hired you. They're like, oh, well, I didn't think about that. It's a good idea. Well, we need this, but maybe not that. And so there's going to be a back and forth during this discussion of the schematic design phase. Yes? You know, it could be something like what you end up ultimately doing is creating an exhibit that's going to be attached to this contract called the scope of services. And that will be a detailed layout. Like, when we did the Haribo factory, that document was 30 pages long. It's not the specifications which ultimately created when you're building the building, but it had a very detailed about when things were coming, like, okay, we had a schematic phase, and here's the drawings and designs that are going to come at this period of time, and then this is the approval process with the city, and then here's these types of drawings that are going to come in design development, and here's the approval process, and here's my value. So there's all this stuff that comes in. So it's often going to be detailed. When I did my 150 square foot addition to the back of my house where we just flipped in inside to go outside, there was no evaluation of that. You know, I gave him the program, I told her what I wanted to do, we sketched some stuff out, and she, I signed a contract with her. So it just kind of depends on the project. But the better you are is to have that more detailed evaluation that you're going to use. So, okay. 324, based on the project requirements, the owner and architect shall prepare and present to the owner's approval a preliminary design. It could be a volumetric. It could be something that is more sketched out. It could have actually some floor plans. There could be more detail to it. But I want to give the owner something to start to chew on. That's the preliminary design that will come in 324. 325. Based on the owner's approval of the preliminary design, Now you're going to prepare the actual schematic design documents. Again, a capitalized term. These are going to be a deliverable. I will provide to you at the end of this phase these schematic designs. And the schematic designs under the AIA basic services are going to be a site plan, if appropriate, preliminary building plans, sections, elevations, and some combination of study models, perspectives, and digital representations. So something that's more than just this volumetric and these initial sketches and stuff. So that's going to have, so the owner can actually see, yeah, this is really kind of getting into it. It's not completed design drawings, it's not anything, but it's more than just, here's my idea of what you're going to have. So, and that's going to be something that's provided to the owner. They're going to take a look at it and say, yeah, keep going. 3251. This is where the architect shall consider sustainable alternatives. Now, in the 2007, it didn't say shall consider, it just said incorporate to your extent. This actually requires the architect to think about sustainability. The owner can say, I don't want to have anything to do with it, but at least this is something that the AAA has done that says, hey, sustainability is a good thing. So we're going to have our architects think about it, and we would like the owners to think about it too. So we're going to require the architects to do that, at least to prompt a discussion. And then the owner may obtain a more advanced sustainable design services as a supplemental under Section 411. So not only is the AAA smart to try to keep sustainability and make it something as a discussion with the parties, but it's smart to say, hey, owner, if you like that, it's supplemental, it's more than basic, and the architect can make more money. So it's actually a smart business thing, too, for the architect. I think sustainability is great. I'm going to show you what I thought about in my design, owner. Do you like that, too? Yes. Okay, great. Pay me a little bit more money. I mean, that becomes a negotiation, and that's when the owner's like, I don't want to do it. It may be, it may not. But at least it has that discussion, so it's got a both environmental and a business thing that I think is a good provision that was added into this document in the 17th. Point 17. 3252. The architect shall consider the value of alternative material building systems and equipment with the owner's program schedule and budget and cost of the work. So that could be like, so we have this, let's say it's a large wide open space that needs some type of truss system to hold the roofing structure up because you don't have columns only on the outside. Maybe it's a basketball arena or whatever. So the owner may have seen something and says, oh, I really want this cool-looking structure that's exposed and has some pictures of some other arena they were at in. But the architect consider alternate materials. Maybe we don't do it just like that because that's super expensive. So there's a way where the architect at least is responsible, shall consider, that we're trying to do this thing within a reasonable pricing. You know, so anytime you see the word shall, it means the architect has to do it. They can't ignore it. They were required to do it. Again, the owner could say, no, I don't want to spend that money, but this is trying to make sure and have the architect trying to say, I'm trying not to build a house that's just with gold-plated toilet fixtures and things like that. Like, I'm trying to be reasonable on this. 3.26. The architect shall submit to the owner an estimate. See, that's the estimate. I've now looked at your program, I've looked at the preliminary stuff, I've created my schematic design drawings, you gave me a budget, I designed it, you liked it, at least schematic-wise, I'm going to give you an estimate of how much it's going to cost to build what I just handed you. And it's going to be the estimate of the cost of work. Now, I plugged in, remember I said we're going to plug in, we're going to talk about 6.3, just so you can see it, because we may not get to all this today, or it'll be the end of the class, and you guys will be tired. This is what 6.3 says. So it's 6.1 and 6.3, but 6.1 says the cost of the work, this is a defined term, shall be the total cost to the owner to construct all elements of the project designed and specified by the architect, and shall include the contractor's general conditions, cost, overhead, and profit. It does not include compensation of the architect, the cost of the land, rights of finance, rights of way financing, all this stuff. So the cost of the work is just to build the project. So the owner has a budget for the project, the budget for the cost of the work. If the owner comes in and says, I have $1 million to spend on this entire thing, you want to say, is that for the construction of the project or does that include my fee? They're like, well, I just have $1 million to spend. Then you say, well, then your budget is going to be $700,000 because I'm going to charge you $300,000 or you have to rent the land or whatever it might be. So there may be a breakdown. So that you've got to make sure that the discussion happens because it's the cost of the work that we're talking about in this document. Owner has a budget for the cost of the work. Architect provides an estimate. Question?
Yeah, I have a question about who does the estimate. Like, it mentions to include the contract for general conditions cost. Is that us saying that the contractor fee is going to be this? Like, is this, or is,
yes.
So how do, as architects, how do we know that? I was kind of always under the assumption that contractors do a lot of the estimating.
So you're right. So the question is how does the architect know this stuff if we don't, like, we don't even know whose contractor we're going to use? So how do we know what their fees are going to be? And so there's a couple of answers to that. One, consistently throughout the profession, the architects are going to be working with contractors. They're going to know what's going on into the industry and everything else. And they still, even though the contractor does ultimately, when the drawings go out for bid, the contractor will do the estimate because they're actually going to be getting subcontractors and everything else. And we're going to get into Article 6.6.4. It's going to talk about what happens when you blow the budget, when you blow the estimate by the contractor side. But the architects still have to have some understanding of cost of materials and how much it costs to build something. Because if I come to you and say I have $1 million to build my house, and you design me a house that's going to cost $2 billion, well, then we've wasted our time. You don't want to waste your time because you're going to have to redesign it for free. And I waste my time because I'm like, you're a crappy architect. You got to at least know what $1 million house is going to cost. So you have to have some of that working knowledge. And you're going to know what's the general traditional fee being charged for this type of house and this type of contractor. So if you're going to have a $10 million house, the upscale contractor is going to charge you more for fees and general conditions than the $500,000 contractor or the $200,000 contractor. So those are things that will be known in the industry. It's not going to be exact, but at least you're putting together, and that's why it's just an estimate. So that's what you're going to do there. Now, to your point, again, about, well, how do we as the architects know? Many architects, especially on larger projects, most of the big architects you're going to work for, you're going to work for, you know, SOM, you're going to work for anybody, any of the big names, most of them strike all these provisions of estimates. They're like, we're not estimators. If you want to hire an estimator, you can. Or they'll say, estimating is going to be done as a supplemental services. We have an estimating branch, and we're going to charge you for that. Because what ends up happening is that the architect estimates that house for $1 million and it comes in at $1.5 million, and now the architect's losing money because they have to design for free. And they don't want to be in that position, so they don't want to have those risks. So, but those are really good questions. And again, that's not going to be in the traditional document. Architects will strike that, but that happens a lot in the industry. And then 6.3 here, it says, the architect shall be permitted to include contingencies, so this helps protect yourself, for design, bidding, and price escalation to determine what materials, equipment, costs, and construction. So it's got this language here is kind of like gives you the wiggle room as the architect. It's like, I can put in some contingencies. I think that the fee is going to be 4%, but it may be more. This is what I'm kind of trying to do. And then it says, you're recommending reasonable adjustments to the program. Maybe sometimes you're going to say, if you have $1 million budget and the house you're telling me has all these things, maybe you're going to need to scale down your program. But I'm not sure because we're looking at what's out there. So in this cost of the work, you as the architect are advising the client. You're giving your best estimate. You're telling where the contingencies may be, where the costs are. But you're also going to say, hey, you're asking for the Rolls Royce and the money you're giving me is a Chevy. So let's try to figure out where we're going to go. So that's what 5.6.3 talks about. And then, as it says here, it says design alternatives. That's where we say, well, we can do it differently. So the estimated cost of the work will meet the owner's budget. Your job as the architect is always to try to come in under the budget or at the budget. That's your estimate. So that's your job, is you're looking at the owner's budget, saying, I'm going to design within that parameter. Any questions on that? Okay. 3.2.7. This is in blue just because it happens at the end of each one of these provisions, but it's important for the reason why. The architect shall submit its schematic design documents, that defined term, to the owner and request the owner's approval. Now, what's important about this for you business-wise is when you go from schematic design to the next phase, design development, you want to make sure you're getting paid for your services. Well, I wouldn't, if I'm an architect, go start doing design development, which is more detailed work, unless I have buy-off from the owner that my schematic is what they want. Because what could happen is, you give them the schematic designs, you don't have anything from the owner, and you start spending time and money on the design development because you've got to hit your schedule date, right? And the owner comes back after 2 weeks and gets a new bill and says, I'm not paying you for this work, I haven't approved your schematics. So now you just lost money. So the point here is, request the owner's approval is really important. I'd get that approval in writing too. Make sure before you go from phase to phase that the owner has said, go forward. That way you don't get shorted on your money. Also, if you've hit the date, maybe it's a milestone date of when the schematics are done. I gave you your drawings on March 1st like I was supposed to. You're supposed to give me a response within 7 days. And now it's March 15th, it's March 18th, and you finally get approval on March 22nd. You're not responsible for those delay days because you hit your date and you're waiting for the owner to hit their date. That's what you should put into your schedule. Schematic designs provided March 1st, owner approval by March 7th. And that way you get the approval, you can keep working, you're meeting your schedule, and the owner's keeping things moving along. Yeah. You may spend the same time. What often, I mean, sometimes a lot of times what happens with billing, the question, by the way, is request for approval, do you get paid at this time? A lot of times billings are going to be just done on a monthly basis. So that's just the way your accounting is every month you send out a bill. You may have a delivery date of a schematic or design development or something before that. So you know you're not going to get paid when you provide those drawings. But you will stop work until you get the approval if you're going to have an issue. Not necessarily stop work. You have built into their functions and everything, so you're not going to stop. But you want to get that approval. And once you get that approval, then when you bill at the end of the month, you can say, this has been approved. So you normally don't get a, here's my drawings, give me my check type thing. So it's more of how your accounting system's going to be. 3-3. Now we're in the second phase, design development, okay? Design development is, you shall prepare the documents for the owner's approval. There it is, right there in the first paragraph. Prepare them for the owner's approval, the first sentence. And then it says, this is going to consist of documents including plans, sections, elevations. Same thing as before. Now we have a little bit more, though. Construction details, diagrammatic layouts of the building system. So now your mechanical, electrical, plumbing, all that stuff is going to come in. And decide the size and character of the project as the architectural structure, mechanical, electrical systems, and other appropriate elements. Now you're going to be giving them more guts. One thing I have to add to, when I said mechanical HVAC, it also includes plumbing. Sorry about that. So it's both the air system and the plumbing systems. But you're going to be giving them in design development, it's going to be much closer to what the final product of the building is going to be. It's not going to have all the wall details and all the stuff that the contractors can use to construct the building, but it's going to be pretty far along the design development. You're going to have floor heights, ceiling heights, you're going to see how the building is structured and how it's going to work. And you're going to have probably what's called one-line drawings, so you're not actually drawing the actual depth or width of a duct, but you're going to know where those systems are going to go because you're coordinating. I mean, if you guys look up in the ceiling here, you're going to see, like where I'm standing right here, right down the middle is the fire protection, which is in red, and then you have two conduits that are going down to deal with the electrical for the lighting system, okay? This was coordinated in the design somewhere. I know we're just looking up in the ceiling, and it's not really that big a deal, but you want to make sure because the way they run the pipes and how they do it, if you look over there, there's a jog on the red right where it has to go around that plumbing. The contractor needed to know where they had to do additional work because that's an additional bend and that's additional work. So all of this has been coordinated somewhere along the line. This is going to happen in the design development phase. And a lot of times you're going to have much more than what we're looking at this ceiling, but you know where this exhaust duct is going to come in, all these types of things, has to have been checked. I will give you one story. I don't remember if I told this so, but I will tell you a story. So I represented an engineering firm that was called in for to fix a floor system. And so they did an addition to the jail out in 26th California. Have I told you guys this story yet? Okay. So there's a jail, but sometimes we get called for jury duty down at 26 and Cal, and there's also a jail there. And so they did a big addition to put a new jail. And what ended up happening was, is because you have the criminals and everything else, all the stuff has to be, like, you can't have an open ceiling like this. I mean, imagine if the criminals could come into their cell and actually start hacking into the wires and stuff. That can't happen. So you have the floors are layered concrete floors, and so they have this concrete plank system. This is not a plank system, we have structure. So you have this concrete plank system, and within the plank, so imagine they're what's called T-planks. So imagine there's a T, and then there's another one next to it, so it kind of makes these rows. And then below that, there's a ceiling, a hard ceiling that you can't go up. And then on top of that, though, where the planks come together, there's a little gap. And so you have to pour a concrete floor on top of that. So when they came in and poured the concrete floor, the planks weren't clean. There was dust and debris, there was cigarette butts, there was candy wrappers. Somebody didn't clean it. So they poured this concrete floor on top of that, and the concrete floor delaminated because they couldn't make a connection because of all the dust and everything else. So it pushed in certain portions of the time, the floor would warp and it would crack. Well, again, that would allow, if you know, you're sitting in a cell, you start chipping away at the floor. I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen Shawshank Redemption, where, you know, he goes and he chips at the wall and finds his way in. But you don't want to have that happen. So my client was hired to come in to fix this. Now, my client had done this many times. When you build a parking lot, same thing, you use this T-structure and you pour concrete on top of it. It's a very common construction system where you pour concrete on top of the structural planks. And one of the ways you can do that is you can come in and they have this viscous epoxy that's kind of gooey and it runs, and you cut a hole in the top of the plank, or the top of the topping, you cut a hole in that, and then you just kind of slowly pump this epoxy and it oozes in and fills in all the spots. And then it's higher, and then it solidifies and it's solid, and now you have the concrete's not going to delaminate and everything is solid and hard and everything else. And they've done this many, many times. So they come in and they're doing there and they're chugging and everything else. What ended up happening was, long before the concrete planks were put down, long before they put the concrete topper down, the architect and the contractor didn't coordinate the electrical and the plumbing systems. And so all the conduits were open. And they didn't coordinate the timing. And so there's these guys downstairs working in the community shower and they're working on tiling and everything else. And my guy's going chug, 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 and he's plugging things through. Well, it hit the plumbing. And they're standing there and there's blue goo coming out of the shower heads. And there's another guy that's working on, he's working on a building in a room over there, and all of a sudden where the junction box comes in, where all the circuit breakers are, there's all these conduits that come down. They're just coming down like this, and they come right in, and that's where you're going to plug in your circuit breaker, where you're going to run your wires and everything else, and it comes out like a Play-Doh factory, all this blue and yellow goo, because they had blue goo in one place and yellow goo in the other place. So it's all coming out, and it's solidified. So you have all these pipes for water and all these electrical conduits filled with this blue and yellow goo, completely solidified. Because nobody coordinated it. Because they didn't coordinate the systems that they had to do here during the design development and when they were working with the contractor. So there's all these lawsuits about, was it the architect, was it the contractor, was it the electrician, was it the plumber, was it my client, like all these other people. It was crazy. The lawsuit lasted, I don't know how many years. We settled out. But the pictures are amazing. Like, you just see, like, a shower with this, like, blob coming down, like, and then they're, like, dripping, kind of like when you make sandcastles and everything. It was quite a debacle. Yes?
In this phase, you start bringing on the mechanical, the electrical...
engineers, yeah. This is when you bring in your consultants at this phase. I would bring in my consultants, actually, in the schematic design. Maybe not as much the detail, but you want to start talking with them, saying, hey, what do we want? But certainly design development, you have to have your MEs, your FCs, and your structural, SE, mechanical, and electrical, E's, sorry, blank there, brain fart. Okay, so that's what's going on here, is making sure you have something more detailed. Now, the interesting thing is, schematic design had a lot of paragraphs about everything that's to be done. Design development, even though it's actually a much more substantive process, it only has a couple more paragraphs because you've already kind of established the process that happens in the previous one. And so what you end up here is under, you have to update your estimates. You don't update the budget. You say, now, it's more detailed. I really know what you're building. And it's not going to be, if you gave me this $1 million budget, I thought in the end of my schematic design it was going to be $850,000. Well, now we're at $920,000. So I've refined my estimate. But we're still under your budget, so we should be good. And then the architect shall submit the design development documents, advise the owner of any adjustments to the estimates, and request the owner's approval. So we're like, here's my next deliverable. Here's where things change. Or the estimates stay the same. And I need your approval before I go to my next phase. Okay? Construction documentation. This is the guts of your work. This takes the most time. If you want to think about it, and we'll have a schedule and a later provision later when we talk about estimating of how you run a business, but it's going to be somewhere between 10 and 15% for your schematic design, about 20% of design development, 40 to 45% for your construction document. This is the big part. This is where you have to staff up. You've got to make sure you have the most architects working on it, because you've got to draw it out now. You've got to draw it so they can build. So you're going to prepare construction documents. Again, a defined term, so you'll know exactly what that means. Construction documents, here's your definition. Construction documents shall illustrate and describe further development of the approved design developments and shall consist of drawing, capital D, specifications, setting forth in detail the quality and levels of this performance criteria, material systems, and other requirements for the construction of the work. Now we're talking about the work here, your services, the construction design phase services, are going to create the documents to allow the contractor to build the project, which is the work. Okay? Contractor will provide additional information, including shop drawings, product data, samples, and other similar submittals, which the architect shall review in accordance with the section. How many people here know what a shop drawing is? Anybody know what a shop drawing? So just a few. Let me explain a shop drawing, product data, and samples. So what happens with construction, let's say I'm designing a structural system. I have a beam, a long beam that goes, and it's sitting on a series of columns. I've gone, because I've worked with my structural engineer, or I remember structures from back in college, I've done my calculations, and I know that the weight that's going to go on that column and the support of weight that's going to go on that beam supported by those columns, that my design of that I-beam is going to be sufficient to hold. There's not going to be bowing or bending or anything else. And I'm going to draw, or put in my specifications, the size of the beam, the flange, whatever it might be, and I'm just going to draw it. It's going to be graphically drawn. I'm not going to have a detail where the connection is between the column and the beam that's going to show how many bolt holes there are going to be and whether it's going to be bolted with different types of things or whether it's going to be welded or how those types of things, how it's going to be, how the connection is actually made. The person that's going to do that is the structural contractor, the contractor that's going to buy the steel and erect it. And they're going to create what's called shop drawings. That's the detailed drawing of how the connection is going to be made. And shop drawings are done for all different types of things. You're going to have shop drawings for electrical connections. You're going to have shop drawings for all different types of things. Like if you're going to be building, let's say you're building a masonry wall, a detailed masonry wall, and how it's going to be connecting to the building, because you're going to have masonry in this sense, maybe just like, in some sense, is a really just thick coat of wallpaper or paint. It's not going to be a structural masonry wall. So you may have a shop drawing for that and how the tie rods are going to go into tie back to the building. There's all different things that are very detailed. Those will be prepared by, it's the responsibility under this provision, contractor will provide additional information by the contractor or its subcontractors. Subcontractors are going to create the shop drawings for the mechanical system, the HVAC, the plumbing, all the stuff that they're going to be building. So the architect draws it graphically, gives you specifications under this provision, and then during the course of while you're getting ready and going out for construction, contractor's going to say, here's a shop drawing. Does this work, architect, with your design intent? So contractors and its subs provide the shop drawings. Product data is like this piece of wood is only going to have a different deflection of X, or this has a certain rating for waterproof or whatever. This is the information about how the product can perform. Samples could be, well, here's brick A and here's brick B. Which brick do you like? You actually see physical samples. All those are provided by the contractor and the subcontractors, but the architect's going to look at them to make sure they fit with the architect's intent. The architect shall incorporate the design requirement of the governmental authorities having jurisdiction of the project into the construction documents. Now, we already had a provision that talked about that. Why is it here? Well, the first one said the architect needs to take into account. Here, when we're building the construction documents that are actually being used for constructing the things, the architect shall incorporate, as opposed to consider when they're doing the schematics. Now, when we're designing it, we actually must follow all those codes and regulations. Because the contractor is going to say, I built what you designed. It's not my problem that it fell down. Didn't you follow code? So the architect here is saying, I'm responsible to follow code. During the development of the country documents, the architect shall assist the owner, so the owner has responsibilities, in the development of preparation of, and here we talk about biddings, and this is how you're going to have a contract. This is a provision here. 343 is saying, I as architect will work with the owner to help you bid this project out. How much the architect is involved in that process depends on project to project. Sometimes you have an architect that's absolutely not involved at all. Somebody else's, maybe there's an in-house procurement department for the contractor or for the owner. Sometimes the architect handles all the bidding. So this is a discussion that happens. This just lays out that they can help with these. I'll help you with your contract with the contractor. As a lawyer, my recommendation is don't draft the contract between the owner and the contractor. Because now you're in the middle of those discussions. You tell the owner, you should probably get a lawyer to look at this. Because if you start drafting the contract between the owner and the contractor and something goes wrong in that contract, God forbid what happens to you. So you don't want to do that. But you can assist. Hey, maybe you should use this AIA form. Because we got an AIA form. Take this form, call your lawyer, and you guys put together the right type of contract. So that may just be assisting there. There's going to be more discussion about certain things, but you just it's a communication more than anything else. 334, look again, you update your estimate of the cost of the work, because now this is what they're really going to build. And then 345, you submit the construction documents, advise the owner of adjustments to the estimates, take any retraction required, and request the owner's approval. Same thing as the other ones. Here's what I believe it's going to cost. Here's my deliverable. Here's where we made changes from the last phase. Do you approve? Always get the owner's approval. Any questions on that? Okay, procurement-based services. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly because it's not going to be on the test, but I just want you to know this talks about, this is one of the areas that I specialize, so I talk about it. This is like, in my practice, I'm a specialist in procurement on the lawyer side. But this is the bidding and negotiation phase. So you can talk about, Section 3.5 is all about bidding and negotiation and what you can do. And there's different types of doing it. Competitive bids and negotiated proposals, and they talk about it here. Competitive bidding is that concept that you always hear, especially in government projects, where the bid, it goes out for bid, and they all come back in, and they all have a price, and it's opened at the same time. You know, like we all open it up, and the winner with the lowest bid wins. That's your competitive bidding process. And you can structure how these proposals are going to do. This talks about your responsibilities. Know that, and I would say less than 50% of the time is the architect brought in to do this phase, but you can be brought in for some responsibility. So, anyway, that's the competitive bidding side. Talks about here, it's additional services. You can get some more money if we have to do multiple phases of the competitive bidding. So another thing for business-wise between that the AA put in here. The second one, 353, is called negotiated proposals. That may be where you send out for bid to 10 different contractors. You get 8 of them back because 2 of them are too busy. You look at the top 8, or you look at the 8 and you say, I like these 3 bids as the top bids. This will not normally happen in the government phase because government always has to take the lowest responsible bidder. But in private projects, you don't have to take, you can take whoever you want. So normally what happens is you take like the best 2 or 3, and then you start negotiating with all 3 or both all the parties that are still left, and you kind of make a horse race. And you don't necessarily say, well, Tom's Construction told me this, and Sally's Construction told me this, so what do you tell? You don't give away their information, but you try to communicate where can you do a little bit better on here because your competition's being better on that. You don't give specific, but you try to do that in this negotiated proposal. And then ultimately one party will win. This is something that I do. This is probably I do more of this than the competitive bid, but I do both. Because I work with both governmental agencies and private companies, but this is much more complex. and how the process works. So even talking to the boards of directors and everything else on the competitive or negotiated bid, it's better for them, especially on the large scale projects. You know, I've gone out to bid some projects with 20 different general contractors. I've gone out to bid with 3. You know, it all depends on what's available in the area and stuff like that. But I've done it for horse tracks, for nuclear plants, for candy factories, hospitals, anything you can imagine, roadways. I've done the competitive bidding process, or the negotiated bidding process. So, and again, there's an additional service provision in here. Okay, so now we've done your design and drawings, you've gone out for bid, you got the prices back, you hired your contractor. What's next? Construction phase. Now we're building the building. The architect isn't going to just go and disappear. I mean, there are some times where the architect, the contract says, I'm only going to give you drawings and I'm stepping back. But a lot of times the architect wants to stay around because somebody's got to help the contractor understand the drawings and interpret. So as the owner, you want the architect around. So now we have the construction phase services. So here it says, the architect shall provide administration of the contract between the owner and the contractor set forth in the A201. That's the other document we're going to talk about next in a couple weeks. So your job, it's not to interpret the contract between the owner and the contractor, but you are going to help them do their job, because there's a whole section in the A201 of your responsibilities of what you're going to do as the architect. So this basically just says, owner, I'm on your side. I'm going to help you with the construction project. You're not the owner's agent necessarily, but you're going to be helping the owner. And if you think about it, what often happens in construction projects is the owner and the architect on one side and the contractor on the other, and there's this adverse relationship sometimes because they always say, oh, the architect's always protecting you. That's not necessarily true, but at least there is this obligation for assisting with that administration. Questions on that? Okay, this is another provision that is real important. Remember I talked about agency before, and I said there's a provision in the AAA contract that specifically says when you're an agent. So you're not always an agent for the owner. In fact, you're only an agent where it says that they, to the extent provided the agreement, only where they say you have the authority to act on behalf. And there's only a couple spaces, and they're highlighted later on, we'll come up to it. But you're only acting as the authority if the contract says you are. Any other actions you have is on your own, but you're not locking the owner in, and the contractor has to know that as well. If the contractor keeps saying, architect told me to do that, the contractor knows that it's only in these couple spots. The contractor knows this agreement as well as you do. The contractor's going to understand that. And in fact, it says that in the contractor's agreement. There's a lot of reciprocal provisions. The other thing that's, so I highlighted that and underlined that just because we talked about it, but the other part here that's really important, that's why this is in blue as well, and there's this provision here that you're going to hear probably as common as what we did in 2.2, which is the standard of care, and says the architect shall not have control over, charge of, or responsible for construction's means, methods, techniques, sequences, or procedures. Now, we're going to stop there. What does that mean? That means I designed the column and beam system. I designed the brick wall. I designed how the doors and windows sit on the house. I'm not responsible for how the beams were welded together. I'm not responsible for how they put the bricks on the wall. I'm not responsible for the way they installed the doors. Swinging the hammer, cutting with the saw, anything that is construction work is considered means, methods, techniques, sequences. Even if you do it in the wrong order, like sometimes you're going to say, well, you should put down this type of floor protection, then you put down your grout, then you put down your tile, then you put down your sealant if you're going to be doing a bathroom. That's a sequencing problem. That's a sequence. The architect's not responsible for any of the sequence of how the order of the work should be done. So this is, again, and this is very important for you guys as architects, is when you're out in the field, don't start telling the contractor how to swing that hammer or turn that torque wrench or cut that saw. Once you start telling the contractor what to do as far as how to be a contractor, you've orally or by your actions modified this. This is a protection against you. If the wall falls down, even if your design is wrong, if the wall falls down because it's been built incorrectly, you may not have so much liability because they didn't build your wall. They don't even know if your wall would have stood up. But what they built was incorrect. And so they're responsible because they didn't do the proper means, methods, sequences, and you can point to this and say, I didn't build that crappy wall. You don't have to. You may have to prove that your wall didn't have anything to do with it, because as long as they didn't build it in accordance with your design, they built it on their own way. They did their own methods or sequences or procedures. So this is like a kind of like a get out of jail free card. And you never want to get into means and methods as the architect. Keep yourself protected. Changes in design build, we'll talk about the next semester, later in the semester, but just for regular architecture systems and services, don't do that. Now we're going to go on. It says, or for safety precautions and programs, connections with the work. So safety is also really important. This is like one of these things where I can give you a couple of examples of projects that I've been in. But it's really hard to think about it. If you're an architect and you walk down a project site and you see an unsafe site, I see an elevator shaft that doesn't have like some type of guard. I see a contractor. I see an architect or a contractor on a ladder that you can tell that it's the ladder's bent and it may fall over. You see that. I see somebody walking on a roof and they're not tied off by safety fall protection and there's holes in the roof because they're building the roof. Those are safety issues. You're not responsible for safety. So what do you do when you see that? Human nature wants to say, dude, that's not a safe site. Like, you want to raise your hand. But you really got to do, for purposes of the contractor, protecting you and your firm, see no evil, hear no evil, say no evil. You got to be out of it. You can't be part of it. Because once you start saying, hey, should we put this protection in front of this elevator shaft? Should we do something about that ladder? Once you do that, you're liable. So this is the part where, and this part won't be an exam, but this is the part where I give you my advice as your lawyer and as a person. Because as a human being, like, you really want to leave that hole open in the roof where the guys walk around without fall protection? Somebody get hurt? No. Do you really want to get your firm liable because you start talking, directing safety? No. So what do you do with it? What you do is you find the project manager for the contractor. You come up to her and you say, Betty, let's go talk over here. I saw a hole in the roof. Your guys aren't with fall protection. I'm just telling you. And then you walk away. Now you put them on notice, but you didn't write it down. You've taken away you've addressed your moral responsibility, so you can walk away from the project site saying, I saw something safe, unsafe, and I identified it. Contractor, let's say that he doesn't do anything about it, and the guy falls to the roof and gets injured. That happened to me on one project. All three examples I just told you about happened. I had another project where the ladder was crooked and bent, and then another project with the elevator shaft. The elevator shaft, the architect wrote a one-sentence note in a meeting minute that was pages, one sentence, that the elevator shaft didn't have any protection. The guy fell and died. The architect had liability in that. Not as much as the contractor, not as much as the subcontractor, but the architect had to pay for part of that wrongful death because they had left that note in there. The reason why you tell someone is because you can take care of it. And here's what happens. Let's say that person falls from the roof or that falls off a ladder or dies in the elevator shaft. Contractor is responsible because in the contractor's agreement, it specifically says it is responsible for safety. It says, in fact, it says it's solely responsible for safety. Not even the owner, not the architect. So the contractor must be responsible. And you're like, okay, but you told them what to do. Isn't the contractor going to say they told me? Do you think Betty's going to say, I was told about this hole, but I didn't do anything about it? Then she's already made herself liable. And then you can say, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not saying you would lie or anything else like that. So you are going to be able to assuage your conscience, at least. And hopefully the project sites you're on are always run carefully and safely. But it's okay, as your lawyer and as a person with good moral value, to talk to somebody. But don't write it down. And like I said, you know, just say, hey, you should go take a look at that. Maybe it can be very obscure, but you should go look at the area where your elevator is. And sometimes you'll help somebody that won't get hurt. And then you won't worry about a lawsuit later because they've taken care of it. So, yes?
So, meeting minutes, they just documented it as an observation?
Yeah. Yeah, they say elevator shaft didn't have any fall protection, didn't have any guarding in front of it.
And that makes them liable?
Yes, because now they have taken responsibility of safety. They have themselves. Now, the liability is not nearly as much as it was in the meeting minutes, and the contractor should have seen it, and they should have corrected it, and the subcontractor should have seen it because it was their worker that was working in that area, and they should have told their subcontractor to be careful in that area. Everybody was at, and sometimes the meeting minutes are only with owner and contractor, and subs don't necessarily go to the meetings. It just depends on the project. So, yes, they're going to have responsibility. And even if it wasn't in the meeting minutes, the contractor's responsible because they left an open shaft. But the fact that the architect wrote it down, they have now assumed a responsibility under the law of assuming safety responsibilities. They're observing a safety condition and they're writing down that it shouldn't be like this. And as a result of that, there was liability. It was, again, it was much smaller. We tried to argue that we didn't have responsibilities, but they came back and said, but you did, because you took the responsibility. And it's weird. You're like, oh my God, like, why should I write that down? Well, because you don't have to. And that's one of the hard things about it. But it's not your job. I mean, it's the worst thing about safety. Like everything else, the means and methods, it doesn't make any sense for you to tell somebody to swing a hammer. That's fine. All that makes sense. But safety, you're like, God, I don't want an unsafe project. But it's not your job. And so you aren't getting paid for that. Contractors make a lot more money than architects. They make tons more money because they're carrying the risk. This contract says you don't have that risk. So... okay, let me continue for the course of the contract. Oh, the architect, nor shall the architect be responsible for the contractor's failure to perform the work in accordance with the requirements of the contract documents. So contract documents are all the documents, that are like specifications, drawings, construction documents, they're all together. They call it as a lump sum contract document. So that's what you put together. It includes this contract, it includes the architect's contract, it includes the contractor's contract. It's this whole kind of morass of everything that runs the entire project. In that, if the contractor is supposed to build the wall in this spot, but it built the wall a foot over in that spot, but you drew it correctly, and as a result of the architect or the contractor building in the wrong spot, they have violated the contract documents. It was drawn correctly, it was told they need to draw, build it as drawn, and they build it in the wrong spot. Architect is not responsible for the contractor who didn't follow the contract documents. It's the contractor's fault. That's another get out of jail free card. Question?
So I know architects who did inspectory construction.
Yes.
If they notice something like that, are they able to investigate their around and be like, hey, that's not right, you're not wrong? Because then the thing earlier about other non-construction people are responsible for construction.
So, let me make sure I understand your question. The architect visits sites on a regular basis, once a week, twice a month, whatever it might be, and if they see the hammer being swung incorrectly, do they have a responsibility if they see that? Is that part of your question? Versus if they see it's built incorrectly after it's built. Not how they built it, but where it's built, like the wrong spot.
It's not necessarily the method of it, but it's if the insurance company can't install where it should have been.
Yes.
That's something different than how
the wall is in the wrong spot. Yes. So the answer is yes, because it talks about here, it says the architect shall be responsible for the architect's negligence, acts, or omissions, but not shall have control of the contractor's omissions or other person's performing the work. There is a paragraph coming up that's going to address this specifically, but the concept is if you see it and it's been built incorrectly, not the way it was built, but how, but ultimately it was built incorrectly, and you see it, you may have liability because you were aware of it, that you knew that the wall was supposed to be in this spot and it was over here. Now, sometimes what happens, I had a project where a lawsuit once where the architect was only coming out on the site because the owner was itself a design builder themselves, and they built a lot of, because they had their own construction branch, and so they wanted the architect for, because they were from another state, they wanted the architect for the local codes and regs, and they were specialists in this type of construction. So the site visits by the architect was only as requested by the owner. And so my guy went out like maybe once every 2 months or so, and between one visit and the next visit, there was a whole bunch of stuff that was installed incorrectly, and the drywall was already up, and nobody could see it, and it turned out that they renovated, revised the entire HVAC system. As a result of that, during the summer, because it's here in Chicago, there was a whole bunch of condensation that developed, because if you take a look at this ductwork here, it's exposed. But if you put it in a space, in an attic space, it should be insulated. Because if you don't insulate it, what happens is this starts in the summer where it's pumping cold air, starts condensing water, and it starts dripping. And there was mold throughout all these buildings. And so the contractor, the owner contractor, sued my architect and said, "You're responsible for all this mold because of your design." And we're like, first of all, you didn't build my design. And second of all, we weren't even there because you didn't call us to take a look at an inspection. So if you don't see it, you can't be responsible for it. But if you do see it, if it's reasonable, there's a provision coming up that talks about it, you can be held responsible. You're not responsible for the fix. Somebody still has to rip out the wall and move it. That's not your job. The contractor has to do that. But if it causes a problem later, like the HVAC system and the duct and the mold, you may have problems with that. And that was our fight, was did we know it or not know it, and some other stuff from that. So 3613, the architect's responsibility to provide construction phase services commences with the award of the contract for construction. So as soon as the owner and contractor sign their agreement, you guys are in construction phase services. You still may be doing design work, actually, depending on the project, but you have these obligations now to start interfacing with the work and the construction that's set forth this agreement. Evaluations of the owner. So here's your part that we were talking about. 3621. Architects shall visit the site at intervals appropriate to the stage of construction or as other required in section 423, which we'll get there. Generally familiar, not everything, but generally familiar with the progress and quality of the portion of the work completed, and to determine in general. I keep highlighting the generally in general because you are not the contractor. If the work observed is being performed in a manner indicating that work when fully completed, not right now, but when it's fully completed, shall be in accordance with the contract documents. So you are there to kind of manage and oversee it, but it's general familiarity. And it's well, it doesn't maybe look right now, but when it's finished, it may be correct. And so there's this, again, a little bit of wiggle room because you're not the contractor. However, and this is the part of the get out of jail free card in this provision, the architect shall not be required to make exhaustive or continuous on-site inspections. Now, some projects will have the architect there every day. There'll be an on-site architect. But most of the time, it's maybe once a week, twice a month. And so what happens when you're not there, you're not responsible. And you don't have to look under every hood or around every door or every corner. You have to do, it's not the continuous exhaustive inspections. And that's going to come down into what's the standard of care. What's a normal architect, what's an ordinary architect going to do on their weekly site visits? Now it continues, the architect shall keep the owner reasonably informed of the progress and quality of the proportions of the work completed and promptly report to the owner known deviations to the contract documents. This is your question here. If they know about a deviation of the contract documents, they report that to the owner. Or known deviations from the recent construction schedule. Hey, they're behind schedule. You're kind of like a watchdog. They built it wrong or they're delayed. And you want to tell that to the owner, and then defects or deficiencies observed in the work. So deviation is the wall's in the wrong spot. A defect is that window's kind of crooked. It's not parallel or flat. Or the floor has warping in it because they didn't let the hardwood cure properly before they installed it, and that's going to cup or whatever might happen. So you have some obligations to still kind of back-check the contractor. But if the defects are because the contractor's work and you tell the owner then goes to the contractor because they have the contract with the contractor. And then the contractor has to pay to rip it out and fix it. Okay? Question here. Great question. So she asked if by owner here, does it mean the owner's representative? So it's a wonderful question. And what I do often in these documents is I add in the paragraphs where I want the architect, the contract, to speak specifically to the owner's representative. Here, the owner as a concept is the owner in general, but you will recognize the communication must flow through the owner's representative for it to be plugged. So if you see this known deviation in the contract documents, and you're friends with the owner of the company that you're working for, but they are not the owner's representative, yeah, you can call the owner of the business. I'd make sure you would put it in writing in a note to the owner's representative. I saw that the wall was in the wrong spot. But this is the owner in general, but your communications want to go through owner's representative. That's why I tweaked this document for that reason. So it's a great question. Anything else on this? Okay. 3622. The architect has the authority. Here's one of the times when you are the owner's representative. The authority to reject work that does not conform with the contract documents. Hey, that wall is in the wrong spot. I'm rejecting that, and my rejection of that is on behalf of the owner. Now, here's where things get a little bit kind of screwy. Because the next one says you have the authority to require inspections or testing of the work in accordance with the provisions of the contract documents. Let's say that you visit the site on 1 week and you're looking at them and they're installing the plumbing in a bathroom. And they've got some of the plumbing up, but it's not all the way through. Some of the plumbing needed to be copper, some can be PVC. But the owner wanted copper in certain areas. And you didn't see any of the copper that was pulled. And you've heard of the contract, you've seen all the PVC the contractor's using. And then the next week you get back, the drywall's already up. So the bathroom's already finished. Or not, it's not completed, like it hasn't been, you know, mud and painted and everything else. But the drywall's there, you can't see it, you don't have x-ray vision. And you're like, oh, I don't know if they put the copper in. I think they ran PVC to all these faucets. I'm worried about that. Because maybe you've had some problems with the contractor before. Maybe you've heard about the electrician. There's a reasonable belief that you have that. So you, on the authority of the owner, can say, rip that wall out. I want to see how that plumbing goes in. You have the authority to do that. The contractor's are like, who's going to pay for it? And you are saying the owner's going to pay for it because if it's wrong, if it's done correctly. Now, let me back this up. If it's done incorrectly and your suspicions were right, contractor has to pay for ripping the wall out, fixing the plumbing, and putting the wall back in. If it was done correctly, you rip that wall out and the copper's there, owner has to pay for ripping the wall out and putting the wall back in. Copper's already done correctly, so you don't have to redo that. So you are acting on the authority, but it has to be reasonable, and that would be a fight between you and the owner, but you are obligating the owner, if there's a rejection of the work and your rejection was wrong, or if your inspection was wrong, the owner has to pay for it because the contractor's like, I did it right, but I had to follow you, architect, because you're the owner in this purpose. Neither this authority of the architect nor decisions you made in good faith. In good faith, I told you to rip that wall out. Shall give rise to a duty or responsibility architect to the contractor because you have no contract with them. The responsibility for those costs is between the owner and the contractor as long as you're acting on good faith. Subcontractor supplier. So this part talks about who's paying for it under the authority. If you told the contractor in good faith to rip that wall down, you don't have the responsibility. That's a fight between owner and contractor. But the owner's going to say, you didn't do it right, so you pay for all the fix. Not my problem, it's your problem. So 3623, the architect shall interpret and decide matters concerning the performance under and requirements of the contract documents written on request of either the owner or contractor. This part here, and the next one, interprets the decisions, this is talking about what happens in a project when the architect has drawn something and the contractor doesn't understand the drawings. Maybe they issue an RFI, request for information. Or maybe they built something and the architect rejects it. Oh, you built it wrong. So now we have this performance under the contract documents and there's a dispute necessarily. Maybe there's confusion. Maybe there's a dispute. The architect in this instance puts on the white hat, is in the middle, and says, here's what my drawings mean and this is what you should do, contractor. Or, here's what my drawings mean, this is what you should have done, and then help divide between whether it's the contractor or the owner to pay for it. And then it says, in 3624, interpretations and decisions of the architect, so the architect kind of has the final say on this, shall be consistent with the intent of, what's the intent of my drawing, and reasonably inferable from the contract documents, and shall be in the form of writing or drawings. So, like, I get this, I'm a contractor. I'm confused by the drawings. I'm not sure how this is supposed to go. I issue a request for information. Architect, can you explain this to me? Architect has to send something back in writing or in drawings to help explain the drawings. Contractor may say, oh, that's not what I thought it was, so now it's going to cost you another $50,000. And then there's a dispute over that. But at least the architect has this responsibility to communicate in writing and in drawings to clarify what the contract documents, what the drawings really say. And they should secure faithful performance by the owner and the contractor, and should not show partiality to other, and should not be liable for the results or interpretations of decisions rendered in good faith. This is that I'm in the middle. I'm wearing my white hat. I'm not on the architect side, owner side. I'm not on the contractor side. I'm just telling you what my drawings meant. And if it costs more money, and you should have figured it out from my drawings, well, the contractor should pay for it. But if maybe my drawings weren't as clear, the owner may have to pay for it, and then we'll talk about it. Question.
What happens if they show that they guarantee maximum price with the contractor, and then they want to
Not necessarily. So she asked the question, what if the project is what's called a guaranteed maximum price? And remember there was that line we said project delivery method. That's one of them. I'll explain it later in the semester. But a guaranteed maximum price has a, like, let me try to do it as simply as possible. Here's my strip mall I want you to build for me. This is on the contractor side, not the architect. I can build that strip mall for you for $10 million, guaranteed, no matter what. And if it only costs me $8 million to build, you're still going to pay me $10 million, and I'm going to make $2 million profit. But if it costs me $11 million to build, you're still only paying me $10 million, and I'm going to lose $1 million. That's a flat, lump sum bid. Guaranteed maximum price says, I've seen these drawings, I'm going to do this project for you for $10.5 million. If it comes in at $9 million, you only pay me $9 million. If it comes in at $11 million, you pay me $10.5 million. However, if during this process, and this is to your question, there's some interpretations and some changes because the drawings weren't clear, a change order may be issued. Let's say it costs another $200,000. Well, my guaranteed maximum price goes from $10.5 million to $10.7 million because it's agreed that that's a change in the drawing, so the GMP goes up. Well, we'll talk more about that later. I don't know if that helps to answer your question. But this is to try to make sure this provision here is less about, I mean, pricing comes into this part, but this is really about trying to make sure the architect's saying is, this is the intent of my drawings. And either you should have figured this out because you all contractors would know this, or maybe my drawings need to be more clear. It may result in cost changes or schedule changes, but this is the, I'm in the middle, I'm just telling you what my drawings mean. And then this is this called render initial decisions. They call it the initial decision maker. And so the architect has to provide that decision between the two in the middle. Like, here's what it's going to be. Drawings mean this. If it's going to cost extra, then owner has to pay for it. And we'll fight out whether my drawings were right or wrong and some other stuff. Or the contractor should have known this, contractor should pay for it. So that's what the initial decision maker does. 3623, the architect shall interpret and decide matters concerning performance under and requirements of the contract documents on a written request. So this is, again, sometimes they'll specifically come to you and ask for this. Wait. Is this the same one? Did I duplicate my slide? No. So this is, if there's a dispute, there's going to have a written request for that. And interpretations of decisions shall be consistent with intent of... hold on a second here. So it's this to talk about the authority, but some of the provisions down here, the authority. Oh, we already did this slide. That's what I'm talking about. Did we already go through this? Yes. I went the wrong way. That's why. I'm like, didn't we just talk about this? Okay, yeah, that got really confused. Certificate for payment for a contractor, 363. So one of the things you do as the architect is when the invoice comes in from the contractor, you are the one that walks around the project site and says, yes, they're 30% done with the foundation, or yes, they put up this wall, or these windows were properly installed. You look at the payment request from the contract, and you, to the best knowledge, information, and belief, because you're not the contractor, you're not doing the estimates, but you're in the field, you kind of know what's going on. So to your best knowledge, information, and belief, you're going to say the work has progressed to this certain point. Yes, they put in these doors and windows. Yes, the foundation has been poured, whatever it might be. And yes, they should get paid. So you're going to issue a certificate. So the foregone, so you're saying, I certify that the contractor told me that this work was performed. I walked around the project and it was performed, and here are the bills the contractor has provided. So I'm certifying that they are entitled to this $600,000 payment for the month of March, because when I walked around, it looked like that work was done. Now you're like, well, wait a minute. I mean, are you going through all the bills? Like, what are you all doing? Sometimes you have to go into the detailed bills, but what you have here is the foregoing representation, meaning you as the architect are representing that this work is what the contractor said, are subject to an evaluation of the work for conformance with the contract document. So it's just making sure it conforms to the results of subsequent tests and inspections to make sure if there was tests or things that were done, and to the correction of minor defects in the contract documents prior to completion. Oh, I'm sorry, and then specific qualifications expressed by the architect. So you're going to make representations based on these four parameters. You're not going to be responsible for, which I believe is in the next slide, issue a certificate of payment shall not be a representation. So when you're saying I certify payment under 3631, you're saying it conforms with the contract documents, the tests were done fine, there's only minor deviations, maybe there's some paint shifts or something that we can fix later, and any other things that I might call out. So you can call those things out. But your certificate of payment, your blessing of that payment, is not based on an exhaustive or continuous on-site inspection. If it was built while you weren't there and you can't see behind the walls, you're not responsible for that. It's not that you review the construction's means, method, techniques, and sequence. You are not blessing how they swung that hammer or spun that torque wrench. You did not necessarily review copies of the requisitions receipts of the subcontractors and other data requested by the owner to substantiate the contractor's right to payment. Sometimes what will happen is it will say, subcontractor electrician is owed $100,000 for its work in the month of March. And the electrician submitted a bill to the general contractor for $150,000. All you're seeing is the $100,000 of the contractor. You're not going to get into the squabble between contractor and subcontractor. So you're not looking for the requisitions received from the subcontractors. You're not going to be saying, contractor, why aren't you paying your sub full amount? You're looking at the contractor's billings. And then it's not the representative, it's not that it's been ascertained for what purpose the contractor has used the money previously paid. What happens if you pay the contractor that $100,000 to the electrician and they didn't pay the subcontractor? They just didn't pay that money. You're not responsible for going back and looking at the business practices of the general contractor. Your job in certifying payment is, they gave me a payment application, I looked to see if it was in accordance with the contract documents, they hit the schedule, there was only minor deviations, and that's what I'm blessing. I'm not going into what's the business practices and what squabbles that may exist between subcontractor and contractor. Okay? Submittals. We talked a little bit about submittals. Submittals were those shop drawings and product data and samples, so I'm going to kind of go through those quickly. You're going to review these submittals. The contractor's going to give you, here, do you want to use brick A or brick B? That's a sample. Or here's the performance function of this pump, or here's an actual shop drawing for that. You're going to look at that and making sure that it's going to be reasonable and in your professional judgment. It is not binding on you. Submittals are not binding on you. Those are the contractor's responsibility, and you don't have to do the math, for lack of better terms. Like, you don't have to check up on the subcontractor to make sure they did it right. You just make sure it looks reasonable within your drawings. That's in 3641. They'll review and approve and take other appropriate actions on the submittals of the shop drawings, data, and samples, but only for the limited purposes of checking conformance with the information given in the design contract expressed. It's not for the purpose of determining accuracy and completeness. That's that specific language that says, I'm not checking your math. If you think that this is the way that the bolt holes should have been and how the welding is going to be and the type of bead you run and what the type of material you run that bead with, that's your issue. I just looks like you've made the column in the right spot meeting up with the beam. So, and any approval and review is not an approval of safety cautions, construction needs, method, technique, sequence, or procedures. Even if it spells out in that shop drawing how they're going to build and all this other stuff, you're just reviewing it to make sure it fits in with the contract documents. You are not saying, I'm blessing the way they're welding it, even though it may say that specifically on the drawing. And that's what this last sentence here says. I'm not responsible for how you do your work. 3643. So this provision says that the contractor, if the contract documents require the contractor to provide professional design services or certificates, blah, 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 the architect shall specify the appropriate performance and design criteria the service must satisfy. So what does this mean? This first part of this provision, there are some times that the contractor has to retain their own engineer. So if the, what's common is curtain walls. If the architect has designed a building that has a cool curtain wall, the contractor is going to have to hire an engineer to make sure that the curtain wall, when built, is designed properly. The architect's going to design it to make it look like it is, but the contractor is responsible for the design work, and they're going to have to hire their own engineer. Another one is for shoring and bracing. So let's say you're digging a property, you're going to be putting in something in the city of Chicago, and you've torn down the building, and it's between two buildings, left and right. And, you know, they're pretty close together. Maybe it's a condo building, maybe it's one of those walk-ups you have up in Lincoln Park, or maybe it's just downtown and you're building a new restaurant or something. And you got to dig down into the foundation to put down a new foundation because you've raised this building, you tore it down. Well, those buildings on either side of you have a weight, a compression of what's going to happen. When that dirt goes away, when you dig that hole, that pressing down is going to press out. There's going to be lateral forces. So what's going to happen is that could actually make the buildings next to you start to turn in and sink. So you have to shore and brace that dirt. You have to make sure that when you dig that hole where you're going to pour your new foundation, it's not going to affect the buildings next door. Contractor's responsible for getting the engineer to make sure that shoring and bracing is done properly. Architect draws the foundation of what they're going to build. Contractor has to get the design professional. So they bring those in. So there's certain times, and the architect has to just give design criteria. And they say, follow code for shoring and bracing in the city of Chicago. That may be sufficient. They may say that the curtain wall has to function in a certain way, up the wind shears and those types of things, and weight and stuff, but the contractor still is responsible for designing that. So this is a delegated design duty. The architect can review and take appropriate actions on those, but they're not responsible, and they are entitled to rely upon and shall not be responsible for the adequacy and accuracy of those services. So anything that the contractor's engineer does, architect's not responsible for. Okay? 3644, subject to Section 4.2, which we'll get there, shall review and respond to requests for information from the contract documents. I've said that a few times, request for information is an RFI. Hey, I need explanation for this, so you're going to respond to those. Architect's response to such requests shall be made in writing within the time limits agreed upon or otherwise within reasonable promptness. A lot of times projects will have an exhibit that'll say, you need to turn around RFIs within 7 days or submittal schedule. If I'm going to give you these bricks, you have this much time to approve them. If you haven't approved them, that will affect my schedule. So the architect will know the turnaround time. If it's silent, smaller projects are maybe not going to have a submittal schedule. If it's silent, what's reasonable to keep the project moving along? So this allows the project to continue. It puts some responsibility on the architect if there's a delay after construction starts, because the architect still has to move along. But the contractor also has to get the submittals before timely as well. Changes in the work. So we thought somebody had some questions. What if there are changes that happen during the course of the project? So under 3651, the architect may order minor changes in the work that are consistent with the intent of the contract documents and do not involve an adjustment with the contract sum or extension of the contract time. Oh, I don't like this color of the paint. We can paint it a different color. Or let's move the location of the light switches in this room. As long as it doesn't cost more money and it doesn't change the schedule, the architect can make these minor changes. Doesn't have to go to the owner. That's all right. Although I would normally, if you're going to change the color of the room, I might ask the owner for that. But it may be like, oh, I thought this was going to be dove white, it looks like eagle white. You need to give it, like, it's a shading issue. Sometimes the things like that. I don't like the way the floors are going down. Let's make a little minor change on how that tongue and groove is working or stuff like that. So that's where you can do. That's one change the owner can do on its own as long as it's not time or money. Project completion. So we got to get to completion. One of them is substantial, the other is final. So what happens at completion? The contractor says, I'm finished. architect has to do something. One, they inspect the work to determine the substantial completion and final completion. They inspect it those two times. They come in, walk around and say, are you substantially complete or are you finally complete? They issue certificates of substantial completion. Here, you are substantially complete. That triggers a whole bunch of stuff legally. We'll get that later in another lecture about what happens with that. But it's important that they issue that certificate of substantial completion, and the architect is responsible for that. Forward to the owner for the review, any warranties. You know, so the contractor's like, I put in this dishwasher into your house, and this refrigerator, and your furnace, and your air conditioner. Here are all the warranties. They give them to the architect. The architect forwards that on to the owner, so we have protection for those. And they issue, when it's final completion, they issue a final certificate for payment, and that has another legal responsibility. It puts obligations on contractor when it can file claims. So this certificate of substantial completion and certificate of final payment, those have specific legal ramifications on obligations and responsibilities of the parties. 3662, the inspection shall be conducted with the owner to check conformance with the work and requirements of contract documents to verify accuracy and completion. You're just walking around with the owner when you're doing these inspections to make sure it's done properly. That's all you need to worry about that. And then all the way down here on 3665, upon the request of the owner and prior to the expiration of 1 year from the date of substantial completion, the architect shall, without additional compensation, so it's free, conduct a meeting with the owner and review the facility and walk around. Basically, what's going to happen here is at the end of the project, at substantial completion, all those warranties for the equipment and everything else are going to kick in, and it's good for a year. And the owner lives in the house or lives in the building or works in the building or whatever happens like that, and things are moving along, but maybe they don't know everything. So what you want the architect is to come back before that year's up and walk the project and make sure that everything's still working. It's before the year because something's not working properly. Oh, your furnace isn't working the way it should. Or, you know, like the owner may not know and understand some stuff. So within that 1 year, so the owner can make a warranty claim. And that's the reason why this is that. Come back and make a project walk inspection. It's not an intense inspection. It's just walking the project site. But that normally will happen before the year's out. So, okay. I talked about additional services. This is additional and supplemental services. This is Article 4. Services listed below are not included in the basic services, but may be required for the project. And then the table below. And so what we have, and this is actually a screenshot from what's the document itself. This is a list of supplemental services. You can add to this. You don't have to do any of these. So you may have multiple preliminary designs. You may have value analysis. You may have post-occupancy evaluation. All these landscape designs, civil engineering, maybe the owner didn't want to do civil engineering, the architect did it. So you can pick and choose from this. It's like a shopping list. And it's something that I, as an architect, when I'm talking with an owner, I would make sure I go over this chart with the owner and say, hey, you know, do you want me to do anything with multiple bid packages? Do you want to do any of you talk to this? Do you want me to do the telecommunications and data services? Do you want me to handle that? Or like I think it was you said the people that had the company that had the lighting system, that would go in here. It would be upscale low voltage lighting or something, and you would put this in here. And then you would sit down here, who's responsible for it? So maybe you need a civil engineer and the architect says it does, this will say owner. So the owner does it right here, if the owner does it. But the architect, you put architect. You just put architect or owner in that second column. So this is just a way to say all of these are supplemental services and they are in addition to my price for basic services. So each one of these, you would give an upscale, an additional price for the overall project. It's identified in Section 401 if it's the architect's responsibility or the owner's responsibility. So in that chart, you would say owner or architect and describe what those services are. That's in 4121 and 4122. So that's it basically on this supplemental services. So supplemental, and the way you think about it, supplemental is not considered structural, mechanical, electrical. It's outside of those basic, usual and customary services. Additional services are maybe you need specialty structural services. Maybe you need specialty mechanical services, or maybe you need specialty electrical services. So, or when we're in the project and it finds out that the design, the way it was structurally, you need to have additional structural members come in, and so there has to be a new design for that. So it's considered the type of services under basic structural, mechanical, electrical, but you need more, and those are additional services. So the difference, supplemental, not in the contract at all, additional is there, but you need more of those that nobody contemplated in the beginning. And so they entitle the architect, if you should, if it came up, and there's a reason why it came up, pursuant to, it's entitled the compensation pursuant to Section 11, we'll get to that next week, about the pricing, and then appropriate adjustment to the schedule. So if you have to do more design for structural, if you have to bring in a specialty electrical contractor for lighting, those may fall under additional services. And there's a parameter of why the additional services should come up. So you got to notify the owner with reasonable promptness and explain the facts and circumstances of why you should be paid more. And so one could be, well, you changed what was the initial information. We went from a two-bedroom, three-bath house, a three-bedroom, two-bath house to a three-bedroom, four-bath house or something. So you changed the initial information. So I get to do more additional services on structural, mechanical, electrical. There's a change in the code. The city of Chicago changed the code between after I designed it and during construction. Now I have to re-engineer stuff to be compatible with the code. Now, if the code changed before your designs were finished, you have to pay for it. But if it's after, the owner has to pay for it because they changed it on you. You didn't do it. If there's been a change in the way the interpretations of the laws, the applicable authorities, 4 here, sub 4, decisions of the owner not rendered in a timely manner. If you, owner, got to me your information later, and that maybe have to change sequencing of how I'm designing, you have to pay me for additional services. Preparing digital models or design documentations for transmission to owner's consultants. That's not necessarily in the basic services, as if you got to do digital and things like that. Preparation of design document for an ultimate bid. Maybe you want to have, like I've had projects where the owner's like, well, we want this basic building, but we want a really cool entrance. We're not sure if we can afford it. So we want you to design it with the basic building that will go out for bid, but we want that cool entrance to also be designed for an alternate price. That's not part of the basic service. That's an additional service you get paid for when you're designing that cool entrance. We had that happen with the project that I worked on. Attendance at public presentations. If you have to go to the city commission and you have to sit there and present the project, that's outside of the basic services. You get paid for additional. Preparation attended for a dispute resolution proceeding. If the architect gets called into court and you have to have them talk about their stuff, you have to pay for them. Qualifications for entries providing bids and proposals. Replacement of work, additional assistance in the initial decision maker. Maybe you're the person that has to be a part of the mediation to solve the problem. So there's all these things. If one of these items happens between 1 through 11, you are paid additional services based on most of the time for the hourly rate. And that's the contract says it's not part of the basic. It's up and extra. The architect needs to provide the additional services and notify the owner within reasonable promptness. Hold on, why is it? Oh, I keep going the wrong way. 2-2. Yeah, oh, this is if they're... Yeah, this is other sets of additional services. So if they're, if the submittal of the sequence, if the contractor's out of submittal, if the contractor has more requests for information. So the first one was all dealing with the owner side. This is if the contractor. If the contractor has more requests for information than what you had planned. If there's lots of change orders that the contractor has, if they want to change what the costs are, those are what you didn't expect with the process and the project. So you're like, hey, I expect to have, a lot of times a project will have change orders, and I'll do change orders up to a 5% increase of the budget. So it's $1 million and up to $1,050,000. I'll do the change orders within my estimated services. But anything over that, I'm going to charge you more additional services because I have to do a lot more work than I anticipated. So evaluating claims, evaluating some substitutions. So there's a number of things that happen in here that under 4-2-2 on the contractor side that may allow the architect to get paid more money. So 4-2-3, during your construction phase services, this is important to fill out, is how many times you're going to review a shop drawing or product data. If you put this down twice, if you have to review it a third time, you get paid additional services. I visit the site once a week, twice a month. If you have to visit the site more, you get additional services. I'm going to do one inspection of the work for substantial completion. If you have to do two, three, four, because you do the inspection once and you're like, you're not substantially complete, then you get called back, you get additional services. And same thing for here for final completion. So you want to fill these numbers out, and you will work with the, when you work for a company and everything, there's going to be standards in the industry of what those come in as far as what those numbers should be. But you want to put that in there, because if not, the owner's going to be like, well, you need to come back and do another inspection, and another one, and another one. And then sometimes you're like, well, how many inspections do I have to do? So if you put down the parameters, once you've exceeded that limit, you get paid for it. Portion 4, except for the services required under 3665, and those services do not exceed the limit section of 423, construction-based services provided more than 60 days after substantial completion. So if you have to keep coming back, normally what happens is substantial completion happens and then there's the project goes from substantial to final. You're like tweaking all the last stuff, painting things and screwing on cover plates and making sure the lights are hanging straight and stuff. Normally that's 30 to 60 days to get that tweaking, the final completion done. Well, you don't want to have to be called back over and over and over because the owner said, oh, I found something else. I found something else. I mean, it's okay if they do because you want to make sure their product is correct, but you should be paid. So if it's after 60 days, after substantial completion, or if there's an agreement, whichever is earlier. So there may be an agreement of when you're going to be paid. But if you come back for more than you should have, you should get paid for it. So these are just some parameters to tell the owner, hey, I got to do a little bit more. You need to pay me for that. And then if the service is covered by this agreement, which could be any services, they're not completed within X months and you'll fill that date in, the architect beyond that can be compensated with additional services. Sometimes what happens is you're in the middle of the design. You do schematic. Your estimate is within budget. You do design development. Now your estimate's gone over budget. You got $1 million budget, and you come back in, and the owner's like, I want you to put in this and this and this, and now you're designing something that's $1.5 million. So you're over budget. And the owner's like, but I really want this stuff. And you're like, well, I can't take it out. If you want me to take it out, we can. But if you want all this stuff, it's going to cost, my estimate, it's going to cost $1.5 million. So the owner says, all right, I need to go raise more money. And then they raise money and it takes, because you put in the months. Let's say it takes 6 months. The project's on hold for a year, whatever it might be. Well, your rates have gone up. You're paying your people. They've gotten raises at the end of the year or whatever your costs or expenses. You're allowed to then, when they come back, to say, hey, it's over a period of time. You should pay me more money because my business kept going. So it's almost like a renegotiation of the price. And this allows you to do this. So I often put it, a lot of times this is like 12 months. That's a common, if the project is kind of on hold for 12 months or so. When you have to re-come back in. Okay, any questions on additional and supplemental services? Alright, Article 5 is the owner's responsibilities. There's not as many here because you got the money, but you still have some. You got to provide information in a timely manner. If I have to give you soil samples, if I have to give you a survey, I got to keep doing that. If I have to return my approval, remember those approvals, those three approvals that we talked about? If I don't give you approval timely, my problem is the owner, not your problem. Because it says, I must be done in a timely manner. I must do my work in a timely manner. I need to establish the budget, and the owner shall update the budget. Hey, if the architect comes back to me and says, it's going to cost you $1.5 million and your budget's only $1 million, we got to figure something out, but I can't make the money for you. So the owner's responsible for updating that budget. And if the owner significantly increases or decreases the budget for the cost of the work, I got to tell the architect, hey, you know, we were going to build this $12 million facility, but it's been a bad year for us, so we're going to take out like one whole section, and my budget now is $9 million. That's a significant reduction. You got to tell the architect that. Or, wow, we did great. We're going to add another addition on the house, so your budget can go up. You need to communicate all those things to the architect under 5.2. 5.3, which was just like 2.3, I have to identify my representative. So it's the same person that's the initial information. Under here, there's a spot, and you're going to put Mike Hanahan is the owner's rep. 5.4. The owner shall furnish surveys to describe the physical characteristics, legal limitations, utility locations of the project site, and a written legal description of the site. So there's actually a legal description, what's called meets and bounds of how they do it, and they describe exactly where the property lines are. There's going to be that survey exactly where the property lines are. They're going to have, somebody should be able to say where the underground utilities, where the gas, the electric, the water, the sewer all comes into that property site. All of that information, the owner must provide to the architect under this contract. Now, as I said, like for my Navy Pier project, the owner shifted all that responsibility to the architect, but in the basic contract, owner has to give the physical characteristics because it's the land and the owner owns the land. That includes the geo survey, but the geotech, and it includes the civil engineering that's going to be talking about what's on the sites and what's underground because they own the land. 5.5. There it is again, talking about the geotech, soil borings, etc., etc. 5.6, the owner should provide supplemental services. So if somewhere in that chart it said owner, this says I got to provide those services. And then 5.7, if the owner identified a sustainable objective, the owner shall fulfill its responsibilities as required. So the owner has to fill out its obligations of what's going to do with a sustainable objective in there. So everybody has an obligation under those that form, the E204. The owner shall, and this is 5.8, the owner shall coordinate, and coordinate's a term of art in architecture, shall coordinate the services of its own consultant with the services provided by the architect. So if we go back to my hotel, and the owner's hired this architect to design a really cool restaurant, the owner is the one responsible for talking to the architect and saying, here are the drawings from my architect. The architect left this space for you to put in your restaurant. You need architect, to design within that space, and I'm responsible for making sure that the information is flowing back and forth between the architect and the regular architect. I am coordinating those things. I take responsibility. Now, as I said, sometimes I'll tell you a provision that I'll change. I never have the owner take responsibility because owners aren't architects. So I always shift this to the architect, and I say, and I'll pay you for that coordination services. They're like, okay, because that's what they do. So they're the ones talking with the architect. So they're the ones communicating, and there's less chance of something going wrong. But under a basic one, because the AA says, I don't want my architect to be responsible for anything but their own bag of tricks, it's the owner's responsibility here. But like I said, it always changes. And then the owner shall furnish copies of the scope of services with contracts between the owners. It's like I have to give you, architect, my contract with my architect. I have to give you their specifications. Which is fine. You're going to need all that information anyway. But I don't want to have to do that paperwork as an owner. That's why I change it. But in this provision, it says the owner has to do that. And the owner shall require its consultants and contractors maintain insurance. Hey, I need you, architect, maintain insurance. You guys don't want to get in a pickle where we're suing you and you have insurance and my guy doesn't have it, so you say back to me, your owner, your architect also has to have insurance, and it's the same, including professional liability, as appropriate for their work. So this is a response, this is a protection for you as the architect. And where are we here? Oh, we're almost, let me get this, I'm almost finished with five and then we'll be done. Sorry, we're going a little over. We've got to finish tests and inspections. That could be the soil tests or what have you. Proper notice to the architect if anything changes or if there's a fault or defect in the project. So the owner sees an error, they got to let the architect know. A lot of times the owner doesn't know anything, but if they see it, like you can't run away from it, whatever is reasonable. The owner shall include the architect in communications. This is what I wanted to point out to you here. This is a new provision in 2017. Remember I said as the contractors, over the years, the owners will want to come up and they'll talk to the contractor. They'll say, hey, will you change this? Will you do that? And the owner's talking directly to the contractor. In the old AIA documents, all communications had to flow through the architect. Owner needed to talk to architect. Architect would need to talk to contractor. And if they talked underneath, if the owner talked to contractor and took the architect out of the bubble, lawsuits still happen where the architect still got sued because the contract said, you're involved. This provision says if the owner's communicating with the contractor, the owner must notify the architect of that. And so the architect is not responsible for those communications, but they, especially if they aren't notified, they aren't told what's happening between owner and contractor, this is a change in the provision that keeps the architect from being liable. And then the last part says, hey, don't talk to my engineers or other people. I'm going to handle my own engineers. Last slide. Before we execute the owner's contract, the contract for construction, the owner shall coordinate the architect's duties and responsibilities set forth in the contract for construction and the architect's services provided in this agreement. Basically, what that's saying is, and you'll see this when we talk about the 801, because I will point them out. There are provisions in this document, means, methods, techniques, and sequence, and safety, the exact same language is in the 801. And so what this is basically saying is, hey, before we, owners, sign a contract with contractor, we've got to make sure that this agreement and the contractor agreement says the same stuff. I don't want to say in the contractor's agreement, architect is responsible for safety, and this one say it's not responsible for safety. So the owner's responsible to make sure that the two agreements are parallel and consistent. Let's see if this goes. We don't have to worry about that last provision. Let's just talk about liens. We'll talk about mechanics liens another time. Alright, so that's it. We're not going to do six. Like I said, sometimes we get through five, sometimes we get through six. You guys had some amazing questions earlier. Thank you very much. I hope that was good. I know this goes long. We will get through the next one, even though there's many more provisions. It goes a lot faster. But thanks for sticking around for a couple extra minutes. You guys have a good weekend.